Know how many are participating online? But you might need to check that.
Let me look at the list.
Okay, maybe you can just have it bring it up while I'm. So happy to have everyone here. I'm Julie Fedorchak. I'm currently the chair of the commission. We rotate every couple of years. It's so great to have everybody together in the room. Fun to see some faces that I haven't seen in person for far too long. So it's really a fun opportunity to get together on a very serious topic. First of all, I want to just do a couple little housekeeping items. And first of all, thank yous. We want to thank our staff. Steve Call, our executive director, back in the back of the room. Steve, wave. He kind of runs herd over our office and got everybody put together for this. Our staff is our technical staff up here, Matt Kluzak and Jason and Stacy, our communications person in the back, and then our smart people lined up on the table here who are going to be asking questions, Pat, Fawn, Victor, Adam, and Jack. Great to have you guys on board and keeping us in line. First of all, our colleague from the South, Christy Fegan, South Dakota Commissioner, made the trip up to Bismarck. Christy, thank you so much. She's super active in SPP. And so we really appreciate her taking time to come up to visit us in Bismarck and participate in person. And I think some of her colleagues are on online, Chris Nelson in particular, for sure. And I'm sure others from other states might be participating that way as well. Let's see. I think Daryl Nitschke from Representative, where are you, Daryl? There's Daryl right in front. From Representative Kelly Armstrong's office is here. Thank you, Daryl. He used to be in Steve's role, so he has a soft spot in his heart for the PSC and all the interesting things we do. So it's great to have you here too, Daryl. I don't think any other offices like the governor's office and our senator's offices are represented right now, but maybe online as well. Okay, I think that's it for the introductions. Isn't here from the industry. This idea came about after the February event, but it's an idea that has been, or it's a conversation that we've been having at the commission for as long as Randy and I have been involved, and certainly since Brian has been on the commission as well. It's just the concerns and the all of the issues we need to think about as it relates to this major transformation of the electric industry that's occurring, and some of the, you know, dangers that exists in that process. And I think we saw some of those issues come to fruition in February. And so it was really Randy's idea for coming up with this conference to bring all the players together. I think it's really great. Obviously, we all get together in different formats and different ways through SBP and MISO. Many times during the year, many times during every week, we have conversations together. But this is a little different in that we're not at one of those locations, and it's a different mix of people. You know, we don't always have the co-ops participating in the discussion with us at the table and with all three of us. So we really appreciate everyone taking the time to come and participate today and have a really in-depth conversation of some of the challenges and opportunities that exist in front of us as we forge ahead on this transition that's occurring with the electric industry. When I was a little girl, I learned how to ski when I was about 4. And one of the things that my dad always taught me, it's weird that he wanted to teach us how to ski because he grew up on the prairie in western North Dakota, so no trees and no, very few hills. But he loved skiing, and he literally would take us to the top and just let us go. And one of his big pieces of advice is don't get too far over your skis. Don't get too far out in front, because what happens? You fall down. And I think that's kind of where we are at risk of being with the industry as we make this transition. We can't get beyond where our technology is able to take us, and where our infrastructure is able to take us, and where the build out and all of this sort of thing, all of these pieces that have to fit together, where the communication systems can take us, all of these pieces that have to fit together to make this work. We have to make sure that we as the regulators, you as the industry, are not getting too far out in front, despite the pressure, despite the interest, despite the competing interests in the different stakeholders. We have to be the ones saying, this is as far as we can go. We have things in place to make sure we're not going too far. And I think that February was an example of us going too far. The infrastructure pieces, yes, it was bad weather, and yes, there were some extenuating circumstances, but that's the case every day in this industry. That's what you all are good at preparing for. And so we have to make sure that we're keeping an eye on that. And so I hope today's conversation really shines a light on some of those things that we need to maybe make sure we're doubling down on, make sure we're not getting too far ahead, and that we have all our ducks in a row to keep the system resilient moving forward. So with that, we are going to lead right into, we tried to break it up so that we aren't all talking at the same time. Randy's going to moderate the first panel. I'm going to moderate the second panel, and then Brian's going to do the wrap up. So that's kind of how we have laid things out. You saw the questions that we set up to frame the conversation, and we really want this to be a conversation. That's why we didn't have the traditional panel where everybody gives 10 minutes of introductory comments at the beginning, and then we go into the Q&A. So Randy's going to lead off with some of the questions, and we'll just kind of jump in as we feel so moved, and staff will as well. And otherwise, I think I envision it being somewhat of an informal discussion today. And so I think that we're ready to get going. There's the bathrooms are out in the hallway. Hopefully you all saw that. And we expect that even panelists and audience members, you can come and go throughout the day. Don't feel like you have to wait for a break to slip out if you need to use a restroom. And then we'll be breaking this morning at about 10:15. Lunch break at 12:30. We'll just zip over to the Capitol Cafe because we really didn't leave that much time to go off-site for lunch. And then another break in the afternoon and hopefully wrap up in time for people to make their flights back home. So with that, I'll turn it over to Randy. Thank you. Did you want to make any comments on that? Okay.
Okay, thank you for getting the ball rolling here, Commissioner. And I'll just say we have a lot of ground to cover, and that's why it's a technical conference. This isn't a formality, or I'm not going to be. If we go through and introduce everybody, we'll use half of our time. I wish we had a lot more time than we do. We don't have time for everybody to give kind of the same answer to every question. So for the most part, kind of direct things at people who we think might have the most broad background on something. And we just need to hear from you. If you completely disagree, let us know. And I expect that many of you will want to provide follow-up information. These five questions, I hope to get through the first three before the break, and maybe even break a little early, because I think that a lot of the discussion needs to be on the last two. And so I'm going to be kind of moving things along a little bit. Like I said, no introductions, but I do want to add to your introduction on Commissioner Fegan. Both of the regional transmission organizations that are active in North Dakota have, of course, a board of directors, but then there's another committee that consists of one regulator from each of the member states. On SPP's side, that's called the Regional State Committee, or RSC, and Commissioner Fegan is our chair and does a wonderful job. And so not only as our neighbor commissioner, but she's here as part of her role on the RSC. So we'll get to these first questions, but I'm going to throw in an extra one to just kind of set the tone of things in my mind that I always have it. And I'm going to direct it at you, Zach Smith, to speak on behalf of your association members. When I ask this, I'm not talking about floods or ice storms or hurricanes or tornadoes, those kinds of unexpected natural disasters. I'm talking about planning for hot periods and cold periods and some amount of unforeseen things and maybe a little higher than expected usage from time to time. I expect that your customers who pay you every month hold you accountable for making sure that they have service. But we know that you're not a generator, you're not a large-scale transmission operator. So who do your member companies feel is ultimately who our mics have to stay further away upstairs? That's right. Okay. Who do you feel is ultimately responsible to make sure that your member companies have the power they need to distribute to your customers?
Commissioner Christman, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Thank you for the question. You know, I think the customers and our members, the association's members, the companies that are up here before you, feel that it's their responsibility. Of course, we all know that it's a shared responsibility among everybody you've brought in here today. But we all know who got the calls in February about what happened was the distribution co-op that served the member. So it's a shared responsibility among all of these entities that are here. But ultimately, where does the buck stop when the power goes out? I think our member companies are aware that they're the ones who are going to get the angry calls and that kind of thing. So the way our business model works, and I know you're familiar with it, is, you know, it flows up. There's the distribution co-op. They work with Central Power, who then works with Basin, and it keeps flowing up the chain. And they all have interface with groups like SPP and WAPA through those relationships, as well as through associations like mine or associations that deal specifically with, like, WAPA, for example, the Midwest Electric Consumers. So it's a complex question, as you well know, but I think the simple answer is ultimately we feel the responsibility lies within our members. So,
okay, thank you. And it concerns me because when you have a lot of different players that are all partially responsible, it kind of leads to a situation where ultimately nobody's responsible. And that I really worry about. The first two questions, I think we can kind of blend together, having to do with what are the main causes or takeaways from the February event and what is each of your role in addressing those causes. And I'm going to direct this first to SPP. I don't know if Kara, if you're handling those questions or if Lanny's doing it online, but what would you say are the main causes or takeaways and what's your role in addressing them?
Well, Commissioner Christman, first let me just ask, can you hear me?
We hear you loud and clear.
Okay, good. Thank you.
And nice to see you, Lanny.
Well, thank you. It's good to see you as well. I wished I was there in person, and I apologize. My my best laid plans didn't go as intended. But it is good to be with you, at least virtually, and I appreciate your question. You know, ultimately, you know, SPP is responsible for reliability of the transmission grid across our 14-state region that resides in the Eastern Interconnection. Primarily, our two responsibilities that are key with respect to reliability include making sure that supply and demand are continuously balanced. So that's objective number one from a reliability perspective. Objective number two is to make sure that the transmission grid can be reliably operated and that the equipment within the grid or on the grid is always operated within its reliability limits. So those are our two key objectives. With respect to this event, there were times when we were trying to perform both objectives. And what we saw occasionally is that while trying to make sure we could continuously balance supply and demand and at the same time reliably operate the transmission grid, that it appeared the solutions conflicted. There were times we were having to dispatch generation down in order to protect transmission elements, but that same generation is needed in order to ensure we can continuously balance supply and demand. So ultimately, you know, we take responsibility as an organization. We are responsible for protecting the transmission grid and as the balancing authority for the footprint, ensuring that load is continuously served. What we believe and what we saw and have observed as the primary causes of the event, and really I would characterize the biggest cause as being a lack of generation availability. We have over 90,000 megawatts of nameplate capacity within our footprint, a peak summer load of about 50,000. And in this time, we did set a new winter record of about 46,000. So while consumption in the wintertime was at an all-time high, we normally expect to have plenty of excess generation to serve that load, but this time we didn't. And so generation not being available contributed mightily to the need for us to shed load. A little over 60% of the cause of that unavailability was contributed to lack of fuel supply. And the majority of that issue is really related to lack of gas. Now, granted, you know, we've got 27,000 megawatts of wind generation nameplate capacity. From an accreditation perspective, we only expect about 3,500 megawatts of wind to show up when we need it the most. So clearly, you know, wind didn't perform at its nameplate capability. It came close to performing at its accredited capability, but still, that's a lot of fuel that if it had been there, would have been really helpful. Gas, by the same token, you know, we have 28,000 megawatts of accredited gas capability. In other words, this is what we expect to show up when we need it the most. We saw somewhere between 12 and 13,000 megawatts of gas generation show up during the winter event when we needed it the most. So, Commissioner Chrisman, I would attribute the primary cause, while again, it was cold, we saw an all-time peak consumption. We were importing a lot of energy from our neighbors, at times about 6,000 megawatts total. And there were times when we needed the 6,000 and it wasn't there. And the combination of all of that caused us to have to shed load. But the biggest contributor was the lack of fuel that was needed to supply the generation that we would typically expect to be there when we need it.
And Lanny, I want to follow up on with you on that because I've been trying to get an answer to this and it's been unsuccessful. But when we say lack of fuel supply, and I'm not talking about the wind or the coal or any of that, I think almost everybody underperformed from what we probably expected, but it was the gas that way underperformed. And was that because of gas production problems or gas, the electric generators' problems of using the gas that they had to make electricity? Or was it because the price got so high that they couldn't afford to use it?
You know, I'm still trying to get some specifics about the data that would best answer that question. Best I can tell, from anecdotal evidence, just talking to our members, what they saw, what they observed, it appears that production was probably the largest reason that gas didn't show up. It just simply wasn't being produced. But I also have been told that there were pipeline issues. And what I don't know is, were the pipeline issues driven by production problems or something else? And so we just don't yet really know for sure. Because I've heard, again, anecdotally, I've heard both issues presented as possibly drivers for the lack of supply.
Okay. Commissioner Fedorchak has a question on fuel supply.
Thanks. Thank you, Lanny. I think it would be helpful too if were the first time the panelists speak, if they can introduce themselves just for folks who don't have the list in front of them of the speakers. Your slides that SPP provided or in the materials to us in advance are really telling. In fact, I think table H and I probably give the picture of the challenge that you guys were facing and that the industry faces as a whole, I think, in dealing with this transition. But I'm looking at your table I, no, table G, which is the coal capacity versus availability. And I see like there's a fair amount on outage and then unavailable on the coal. Now, if all of that had been available, you still would have been short. So that wasn't the solution as a whole. But what was the reason for the outages on the coal side, both the unavailable and the outage? Were there planned outages at this time? And is that typical? Do you allow those in the middle of February?
There typically are. Well, let me first answer the question about the outaged capacity on coal. We did have some generation that was in the midst of maintenance activities. They were outaged because of the need to perform maintenance. Now, a couple of weeks ahead of the event, as we began to realize that, you know, just how significant this event was going to be, at least predicted to be at the time, we did begin to work with a lot of our members who had already scheduled maintenance activity and were able to defer a lot of it. And we still ended up, I want to say, with about 3,000 megawatts of generation that just couldn't be returned back to service. They had already started the activity and just were unable to bring those units back. What I don't know, though, Commissioner or Chair Fedorchak, I don't know how much of that was coal. I am aware of a few outages, not a lot, but, you know, probably combined about 1,000 megawatts or so that became forced out during the most extreme parts of the events. And then I'm also aware of one issue of coal just simply not being available. And in fact, I remember getting a call from the owner of that plant saying, you know, I can get coal from somewhere else. Somebody else has a plant that has excess coal and they're willing to ship it to me. But where do you need that the most? Because if they have it and could use it for their plant, will it make the situation better or worse if they transfer it to us? So I do remember that conversation, but those are about the only specifics I have related to coal and, you know, how it performed or didn't perform during the event.
And I'm going to just say, Lanny, I appreciate when someone admits that they don't know something instead of bluffing. And so I appreciate your answers this morning. And I will say that SPP, and I'm sure MISO is the same, we'll learn this afternoon, is in an intense period of studying these issues. And in our case, Christy and I are practically overwhelmed on the RSC with various parts of that study and in all aspects of what SPP does, with the hopes of getting final reports to the full board by the quarterly meeting in late July. So I do understand that we're in a learning process yet, and so all the answers aren't available yet. When it comes to these key takeaways and your particular role, Zil, Tom or Val or Jean, Basin Electric, you have coal, you have gas, you have wind. I'd like to hear what your key takeaways are and your role in addressing the problems.
Well, I guess in my comments probably come more, not so much market related, but more just the physical. And
Tom Christensen, Basin Electric, the executive, director, VP of Transmission Engineering and Construction.
Thank you. I apologize. So I guess, again, my comments come more from not the market side, more the engineering operation of our system, particularly with respect to some of our transmission system. We have a number of coal plants, and actually they performed very well. We did have one issue on that Sunday, and I think you see it in one of the graphs that was shown. Our Lyol station unit number two was unavailable on Sunday, came back on Monday, but it really wasn't an issue with the coal plant. It was a failed breaker in our switchyard that took the unit off. We had crews working until just about midnight Sunday night in minus 38, 39 degrees, but they got the unit back online. So that was our one issue with the coal. Again, it wasn't a fuel supply issue. It was a failed breaker in the switchyard that caused that issue. And I guess, I don't know if you want to add anything, Val, about the gas units.
I'm Valerie Weigel. I'm the director of our asset management and commodity strategy group at Basin Electric. And just to get back to the question again, make sure I'm answering the right thing, is what was our role in addressing the cause? And Tom, you asked about our gas units. We had about 700 megawatts of natural gas running up here in North Dakota and South Dakota between the generators that we have. And we were able to procure natural gas and run the units that we had available in that time frame. In terms of some of the other issues, kind of in getting back to the cause and back to some of the things that were talked about, I also believe it's a joint role and responsibility between Basin Electric, between SVP, between WAPA. All of us played an integral role in making sure that our members end up with reliable power. And thinking about what our role is in that and how this filters down into the energy that we have available during some of these timeframes, the whole process starts out with ensuring that we have enough capacity to provide to the market. That's one of our responsibilities. We have to make sure that we show the market that we have 112% of our load in capacity, and that can be steel on the ground purchases. It can be steel on the ground. It can be through purchases. It can be through multiple ways. But then it comes on our responsibility to make sure during these events that we're following SPP's market dispatch. They're trying to make sure that they can get all of this energy to the loads reliably and responsibly. But in terms of that philosophy in terms of that dispatch, and how does Basin Electric think about our capacity and what kind of capacity we're bringing to the market to make sure we can reliably serve our load? One of our roles in addressing this would be our philosophy and how we think about what kind of generation do we want to show for capacity and what kind of generation do we want to have available for energy to serve our load. And one of the approaches that one of the strategies that we take is we look at the kind of generation we have for capacity, whether it be gas, whether it be coal, whether it be fuel oil or wind or solar, And in our forward planning, try to make sure that we have enough dispatchable generation that could cover our loads at any given point in time. So it's taking a hard look at the mix of the resources that we bring forward to prove our capacity to make sure that we can have the energy for those resources during these periods of time.
Is there a problem in the dispatchable generation sources not being adequately compensated and basically being encouraged to disappear?
I think there are definitely challenges with ensuring there's enough revenue from the market provided for these resources to continue to be viable going forward. That's one of the other areas where I think we also have a great opportunity to participate with SPP and in the development of some of these products that can compensate some of these market products that can compensate dispatchable resources for the services they do provide. There's a multitude of products that are under development in the market right now that can help to provide compensation for coal resources, for gas resources, for wind resources, for all of the various fuel types. But these products are what the market works on focusing on providing more revenue to the resources.
And you said that you're responsible for having available 112% of your demand. Where is that? Is that your number? Is that what SPP requires? Is that what FERC requires? Is that what the PSC requires? Explain that 112%.
Sure. That's a reserve margin that is set by SPP. It's based on peak summer loads. And that's the responsibility for each market participant to show that they have that amount of resources to cover the load, their peak load that they have in the market.
And does February tell us that either that 112% is too low of a number or that various generation sources are improperly appropriated to account for that?
The current reserve margin is based on a summer peak load. There is discussion in some of the working groups to look towards setting a reserve margin for winter peak loads. So that could be one of the areas that could be looked on for a change in reserve margins. There's different capacity levels that resources can act at in the summer versus the winter. And Lanny, maybe I'd defer to you too if you have anything additional to add to that.
Sure, and thanks, Valerie, for taking advantage of the opportunity to answer the question. I think you did a really good job. I will add, though, Commissioner Chrisman, that one of the delegated authorities that the Regional State Committee of Southwest Power Pool has is to ensure that adequate resources exist. And so there is a resource adequacy component that, you know, when we say SPP, a lot of times we refer to SPP as the organization, as opposed to just SPP staff. And while it's true that SPP staff performs the evaluations, the loss of load expectation studies, and the effective load carrying capability studies that are used to determine how much capacity should be accredited and should be counted in order to show up when you need it the most, it's really the organization that works together, and it's the RSC and it's the membership that works together to ensure that we have set the right requirements for resources and how much excess capacity is needed. I do believe, and I've said this a number of times, that what we saw in the wintertime is a capacity accreditation issue. And Valerie hit it. I mean, we do currently perform summertime analyses, and the requirement is established based on a summertime expectation, primarily because that's when our peak demand is the greatest. I think we're going to have to, and I fully expect this will show up in our comprehensive review report and set of recommendations for improvements, I think we're going to have to start considering performing winter season and maybe even spring and fall at some point evaluations to determine what the requirements should be during those seasons and how to accredit capacity properly so that we have a real good feel that we can be confident that the capacity we believe is there will actually be there.
Okay. Matt or Mark, you guys from the distribution side have any thoughts that haven't been expressed regarding the causes of the problems and your roles?
Yeah, just to reiterate, the distribution co-ops are the front line with the customers. Customers don't know who Basin is, more or less. Sorry. The customers certainly don't know who WAPA is or who SPP is. So when there's trouble in the system, they come looking at us for answers. But some of it's out of our hands. We're not responsible for load resource balance. So we're at the, I wouldn't say mercy, but other entities control that part of our business. But the advantage we have is we know our customers. So when we get the call that we have to shed a certain amount of load, we know which customers to call and which customers can voluntarily shed load and which can't. So we have an idea of where to start picking customers that need to be shed. And that's what we did. And I can explain more later if you'd like. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Matthew Stoltz, senior engineer for Mont Williams Electric Co-op.
All right, good morning. I'm Matt Hansen. I'm the chief operating officer at McKinsey Electric. To answer your question, I think very similar to Matt. I mean, we're dealing with the members at the end of the line. And, you know, for us on that day, you know, the thing that impacts us, a large part of our member base is oil and gas production. And so when we got the call to shed load, we were directly impacting the natural gas supply. And significantly, and we just don't have a large contingent of other, I guess, discretionary load that we could ask our membership to shed. So it kind of was a double-edged sword on that day. You know, McKinsey system, we performed well, we communicated well. I think there was definitely some communication challenges that we can share and talk about later in that whole event for us. But again, like Matt mentioned, we're dealing with the member at the end of the line, trying to help communicate to them of what's going on. And our due diligence is to do whatever we can to make sure that that energy is flowing to that member, especially with a large part of our contingent also relying on electricity to heat their homes. So it's a big deal for us to make sure that it's done and done well. We do have a part in the planning and adequacy. I mean, we share our forecasted load profiles with our G&T that goes up through Basin, and that all has to be in alignment. If we don't share well the information, then that is a snowball effect, cascades through the rest of the planning effort. So we don't have direction on how the power is produced and where we get the electrons from, but we do have to make sure that our loads are well known and that we're communicating that up to those folks that do provide us that critical energy.
Okay, and on the load shed stuff, we will be coming to you both, as well as you, Mr. Linke, with the next question as soon as we wrap this one up.
Commissioner?
Tom?
So a lot of good comments, and I, you know, a lot of this, you know, looking at wintertime accreditation and good ideas. I wanted to kind of pull back and just kind of tie in what some of Lanny's initial comments were with regard to fuel supply. And then we talk about the 12% reserves. And 12%, if you have 100 megawatts of load, you have to have 112 megawatts of accredited capacity. And that all ties in, and there's a lot of loss of load expectation studies that are done, et cetera. But this fuel supply adequacy issue, I think, ties in. I have an example. Just to kind of make it stand out, if, you know, we all have these delivery services, probably during COVID, we got more packages from Amazon than ever before, but there is a need for the package delivery system, whether it's FedEx or UPS or whatever, to deliver packages, and they need vehicles. And just as an example, let's say you need 100 vehicles available every day. And so you have some amount of extra vehicles because there's outages, right? The engine went out, there's other issues with the vehicle. Call it 12 extra, 12% reserves. And so the probability of, you know, the first vehicle having an outage is really independent of the second vehicle, is independent of the third, et cetera. So on that basis, you have a very, very high probability you will have adequate delivery vehicles every day until you run out of fuel. And that is, in my mind, again, final reports to be written, but in my mind, that is what happened to us. We ran out of fuel. And in that case, and in the electric side, you can add more vehicles to that delivery fleet. You can add more generators to the electric grid. But unless there's adequate fuel, you will not have solved the issue.
That is a great example, and I appreciate it.
And Commissioner, I'll just add one other point here on the entire piece here that we cannot lose sight of is the monetary impact. So electric rates are very important to, especially for us as a rural co-op, keeping our costs in line. So we cannot lose sight either of that balance between reliability and cost. So we could add definitely larger capacities and larger different things to help make sure at the end of the day, there's always going to be energy there. But it also has to balance with, can the member afford whatever the decisions are that come out of the recommendations? So I think that we have to make sure that we keep that in mind, that we don't lose sight of that price per megawatt that membership has to pay.
It's a good point. Thanks.
Thank you. Just sort of on the same topic, what role does fuel diversity play in the capacity requirements, like 112% that SPP requires? Should there be further requirements for diversity, or whose job is it to determine the mix and what kinds, just to get to that whole point on fuel? If you don't have the fuel, you can't run the power. That was a big problem in this, and fuel diversity is one of the issues that gets to solving that problem. But whose job is it to look at that mix and require the diversity or dual fuel fed generators, that type of thing, just to ensure that we don't in tight times rely too heavily on one source? And I'll throw that out for anyone to respond to.
Well, if you don't mind, I'll take the first shot at it. And I keep forgetting, I apologize. I'm Lanny Nickel, Chief Operating Officer for Southwest Power Pool. SPP's loss of load expectation studies, our analyses do consider, as those are performed, the diversity of the fleet that we have. And so that is taken into consideration, how well it performs, you know, your typical outage history, all of that historical information is included and considered as a part of the analysis. Having said that, SPP has never, to my knowledge, what we've really advocated for is diversity, that there is benefit and value in having fuel diversity. And if you take Mr. Christensen's example, if that fleet of fuel or delivery trucks or delivery vehicles had diversity of fuel, then any one fuel outage wouldn't cause an extreme problem. I do believe, and I hope to see this in the final report as well, that SPP is performing, that as the RTO, we do need to step up. We do need to show some real leadership and determine and assess what are the minimum characteristics that are needed among the generation mix. So far, we haven't done that. And so far, it's entirely dependent on the market to provide generation. If you look at our generator interconnection queue, the majority, we've got 100,000 megawatts of generation interconnection request in the queue, with the majority of that being wind, solar, and storage. There is a little bit of gas generation included, but not a lot. And so I think we're going to have to step up and hopefully the other RTOs do as well, and really start expressing what we need in terms of the types of, maybe not fuels, but at least the attributes. You know, for example, quick starting, quick responding generation attributes, generation that isn't as dependent on highly variable fuel. Those are the kinds of things I think we're going to have to study, and we're going to have to express that and inform our stakeholders and our country of what is really needed in order to keep the lights on in the future, particularly as we continue to see a transition toward more and more renewables.
Thank you. And Tom, was that essentially the answer you were going to give? You were just ready to say something? Okay, I'm going to jump to this third question then, because Mr. Linke looks like he's anxious to get involved here. And the third question was an explanation of load shed plans, but as well as not just plans for the future, but lessons learned from February. And I'm going to start it off with either Zach or some of you individual cooperative members. I'm not doing this with every question, but at least this first round. But were the load shed plans appropriately communicated and in advance, like on Sunday before the shedding started, were you told to urge customers to conserve energy?
Well, Commissioner Crispin, this is Zach Smith. I think, being that this is a technical conference, I think I would be over my skis, to Commissioner Fedorchak's point, if I were to try to answer that question, because those are conversations that I typically don't have any part of, and there have been a lot of conversations since, so I think it would be better answered by other panelists here.
Paul?
My light's on. Is it on?
Oh, okay. It's brighter now. Paul Fitterer with Capital Electric Cooperative here in Bismarck. To answer your question, it was not a direct communication to monitor or alert our members and so forth. I was sitting at a stoplight in Northwest Bismarck on the morning that we first were disconnected, and the lights in front of me went out, and I knew what it was. So we had been monitoring the EEAs. We had experienced an EEA 3 the day before. There was nothing that occurred in our area. So it was more just kind of a word of mouth, like, hey, we should be watching this and that sort of thing. So the communication can be improved. We certainly have been working through that upstream with all of our partners in the process. WAPA has taken the lead. And so they're working on a more of a communication process to make sure that we're notified as events begin to happen. At the same time, I'm not pointing the finger. We internally at the distribution level are also establishing our own plans. One of the most common questions that members asked is, why didn't you let us know? There was a lot of misunderstanding on the whole thing, but and I'm embarrassed to admit that I was literally sitting there at a stoplight when the power went out, and I just had, I guess, made some assumptions that we would be notified as part of the process.
Had you been requested to request your members to conserve energy on Sunday already?
We had some notification, and we had load control active prior to, as the EEAs were warm, ramping up. Tom, do you want to stretch on that?
Tom Ellen was general manager of Central Power Electric Cooperative. We had been notified by Basin Electric of the impending EEA status, and were requested to try and enact all of the load management capability we had. And on Monday and Tuesday, we worked with our members and notified them that we were going to be implementing full load management control to the extent possible. There's definitely need for, or room for improvement on the communication. As Paul pointed out, we really need to get more direct communication from WAPA as the TOP, so we can be a little bit more in the know and have more visibility on what's going on. But that's something that WAPA is already working on, so we feel pretty good about that.
Matt or Matt, anything different from your perspectives?
Yes, Commissioner. Matthew Stoltz, Montreal AM, Senior Engineer. We had a much different experience with WAPA. Our general manager was called about 4 o'clock in the morning on Monday and told that there's going to be some trouble with resources. So that first thing that morning, we geared up and started contacting our industrial customers, seeing which ones could voluntarily curtail load. Did that through the morning and did cut some load in that fashion. And then about, it was probably about 9 o'clock in the morning, we got word from WAPA, we had to cut, I think it was 18 megawatts. And so we had some customers that were ready to go next to meet that need from WAPA. And that continued through the lunch hour, I believe. And then by 1 o'clock PM, we got the word we could restore those customers. Also, I want to take a bit of a sideline and describe Montrolium's distribution design philosophy. Montreal operates an extensive 115 kV network system that's integrated into the SPP footprint. Montreal is a SPP member on the transmission owner side. WAPA controls the entire system. WAPA probably has about 20 deliveries in the Montreal that they have direct control over. Also on the distribution side, Montreal has a 24-hour dispatch center. So Montreal has very fine control of these delivery points as far as automation and communication is concerned. So when WAPA calls for cuts, we're able to really dig deep granularly and cut off loads at the smallest possible increment and spread them throughout our system. So that was an
And you made those decisions, which megawatts or which circuits to cut off, right?
On Monday we did. Okay, so Monday we made the decisions on which customers to cut. And that was probably for 3 or 4 hours. Because Monday wasn't as severe as Tuesday. Then Tuesday morning came and things seemed like they accelerated much faster as far as the lack of resources. And WAPA did cut one customer, but because of their ability to see deeply into Montreal's Network 115 system, it was only about 10 megawatts of load that was cut on Tuesday. So the involuntary or the WAPA unilateral actions were very minimal. The majority of the actions were Montreal picking customers that had the ability to perhaps withstand the outages more so than other customers. But it was all communicated very well between Montreal and WAPA. So from our perspective, we thought WAPA did a very good job of communicating with us. That was just our experience. So thank you.
And Matt Hansen, I think you have a little bit different take.
We have, yeah, yes, absolutely. And I guess first off, to just put a little setting out there, I've been in the control rooms before, and I can only imagine what the folks that were sitting behind the screens that day trying to figure out how we get the load where it's got to be. And that transmission operator that's sitting there looking at some point, I know we had a couple calls, the system is going to collapse. And that means relays start to open up when the grid gets to a certain level, and then it just starts cascading. So those guys, I think, need some probably a little bit of appreciation because they probably had a pretty tough go that day. But yeah, we did have quite a bit of a different experience. I think day one was better than day two. Day one, we got a call maybe an hour, hour and a half, notifying us that, and that was Monday, and notifying us that we needed to shed about 40 megawatts of load. And we were given about an hour to do that. 40 megawatts of load, you know, we don't have, at least at that time, a 40 megawatt easy button to go push. And we know that pretty much of our, you know, roughly 80 substations, most of those have some sort of gas or oil connectivity to them. And so we know that if we impact substation A, it's probably going to have some sort of cascading impact on the natural gas production business. And obviously we don't want to do that as much as possible. So we pulled some of our largest producers, and that short hour had a couple conference calls and was able to at least come up with some sort of plan to come within an hour, find a way to get 40 megawatts. And then when the call came, it was 15 minutes. You got to be down 40 megawatts. I don't care how you get there. You got to find 40 megawatts. We did that. And then on day two, we received zero notification, and actually WAPA had opened up one of our larger delivery points, shutting down roughly a million cubic foot a day of gas plant, just like that. We lost about 10% of our load. And anytime you shut down those gas plants unexpectedly, they don't come back immediately. It takes time for them to regain their production. So after that, we have a load management plan that we actually ended up sharing with WAPA. The end of that day, we actually implemented, similar to Montreal Williams, very piecewise load shedding plan to give WAPA different increments of how much megawatts they'd like to shed. We worked heavily with our oil and gas production, as well as our just residential and urban and you know, agriculture members as well, farmers, ranchers, just a lot of communication. So again, we really received very little notification on the upfront end going into it. We actually had some of our members calling us asking what's the deal until we got the call on Monday to start doing that load shedding. But again, I think coming out of this, there's going to be a lot of changes and a lot of plans. I know WAPA is working on putting a lot of that together to help have those plans in place for next go.
Okay, I'm going to bring in Mr. Linke now, but first, I just want to explain, because I think there's a lot of people that misunderstand this, because Basin Electric is so prominent in North Dakota and Central Power. I think a lot of people think that these co-ops get their power from Basin Electric, and that's just that. But WAPA kind of has been quieter, but is actually the transmission operator that serves these co-ops and some municipals in the state. So Mr. Linke is the VP of operations of WAPA, and I appreciate you taking your time to visit with us this morning. My first question for you is, of your customers, how many of them are able to shed a certain amount of load that you tell them they need to, as opposed to you have control of the switch and have to make that determination?
I guess I'll start out by saying thanks for inviting me. I know there was some confusion to begin with as to whether I'd be able to participate, and I'm glad that that I got that all cleared up and I'm able to participate today. I don't have the exact figure as far as what percentage of our customers would have that capability. I don't have the right, I don't have that number right at the tip of my fingers. I think the vast majority do not, at least from our past experiences, but I don't have that percentage at the tip of my fingertips.
It seems to me from what I'm hearing that is the case, that for the most part, it is someone at WAPA that is shutting down circuits. And you do that remotely from a central office somewhere, right? It's not people out in the field going out and shutting these down, right?
Correct. It's from our control center in Watertown, South Dakota.
So how do you feel about the communication in February with your customers in giving them advance notice, clarifying if they had preference maybe of what circuits were going to be thrown, as well as I want to come back to my earlier question, which if it was answered, I really didn't catch the answer, but when SPP was communicating for conservative operations already, at least on Sunday, maybe even Saturday, was that message delivered to your customers?
Well, communications could be better. We've decided that we need to take a more active role. Historically, we've allowed the larger entities, the consolidating entities like Basin Electric for the co-ops in the Dakotas. There's Missouri River Energy Services that deals with most of the municipalities in the Dakotas. We've sort of stayed in the background and allowed them to provide most of the communications to their members. As a result of this event, we've learned and have decided that we need to take a more proactive role. And so we are currently developing procedures whereas all these alerts and you know, the conservative operations, weather alerts, the EEAs, we're developing email exploder so that we can send those out to the people that want that information so that they can share it with their customers. So we've decided we can no longer, that we no longer can play that role in the background, that we need to take a more proactive role. So I'm not certain how many of the customers knew about conservative operations, which started, if I remember right, started maybe even Friday or Saturday of the previous week. That is one area that we've realized that we need to take a greater role, and we've already started developing processes to do that.
And so that's one aspect of the communications. And then do you feel like your customers have a good grasp of what the load shed plan is?
I think it depends on customers. Some of the customers had a grasp on it. I'll tell you that, you know, when it happened on Monday, we contacted primarily people that we knew could manage it on their own. So we only contacted a few entities, and then we prepared for potential curtailments on Tuesday. We just didn't think they would be to the magnitude that we experienced on Tuesday. So, you know, on Monday afternoon, we were calling the entities we thought we would have to curtail if something happened on Tuesday, but the numbers that came in were over twice what we were expecting to potentially happen. So as those curtailment requests came in, we quickly went through the folks that we had coordinated with on Monday, and then started to have to do some additional coordination when we could with the other load serving entities to try to minimize the impact, but still meet the requests that we had from SPP.
Paul, any thoughts on the communications side?
Yeah, Paul Federer, Capital Electric Cooperative. I think this is a great opportunity to take the steps that we know weren't working. And so, the communication side, we're looking forward to having what Lloyd mentioned. And in terms of to our membership, we have communication methods in place as well. So if we're notified downstream, you know, we'll be certainly to get those out to our members and be able to do voluntary load shedding and other methods of preparing our members as well. Did I answer your question? Or
yes, do you have remote capabilities? Like, if you had wanted to make sure the streetlights would keep going where you were at, could Capital have chosen a different circuit to shut off at that moment instead of the one where you were? Or do you not have that?
Yes, Capital does have a SCADA system that we use that we can do that. We'd start by making sure the commissioners had power anybody on our lines, but after that, and so we did have a plan in place. Again, we made the assumption we'd be notified, but we had a plan in place for what we would do if we needed to shed 10 megawatts, 20 megawatts, and so the surprise was more the fact that it was, you know, breaker was open for us and it was done, and that was, you know, emergency conditions. But we do have one, and I know a number of central power cooperatives do as well.
Val?
Yes, this is Valerie Weigel again. I just have one point of clarification that I want to make. As the responsibility of the generators at Basin Electric, there was a communication process, and there is a communication process in place that goes from SPP to the market participants. There are emails that go out every time there's a different breach of a type of event. Back on February 8th already, we started getting notifications that we were in a resource alert event. The next step there is a conservative operations event. Then we go into the EEA 1, 2, and 3. So we were aware as we were moving in and out of each of these events. We weren't necessarily aware that load shed was going to happen at a specific point in time, but we were made aware of each of the events as we were going through them.
And Tom Mellon, Central Power gets those same kinds of notifications?
We do not. We're not a market participant. We're simply a transmission owner in SPP.
Okay.
And that's an area that we really need to improve. And as was said by Lloyd before, they're working on that communication to any entity that needs that information and wants it, and we would certainly be one of them. That was the largest complaint to our membership, our six member co-ops, was that they had no heads up on this. As Paul mentioned, three of our six members have SCADA control of their distribution system. We do not have a dispatch center at Central Power. We rely on WAPA for the most part, and also Minn Kota and Otter Tail, and to a small extent MDU. So it's a little bit more difficult for us to take the steps that, say, Montrilliams was able to take with their own dispatch center, their whole system.
Do you know? Would you say those three that have the capability, do they want that control, or would they prefer, do you think, to have WAPA manage that?
Well, first off, we recognize very clearly that we need to work on internally what loads our members want to have curtailed. I think WAPA relied on a plan that had been worked on with its preference customers probably years and years ago. And frankly, we weren't familiar with that. So we would like to work internally and are working internally on coming up with a load curtailment plan, both between our members and what we would have WAPA implement, as well as Minn Kota and perhaps Otter Tail. Although Otter Tail is mostly in the MISO side, so it would be a different set of scenarios there. The problem with WAPA doing the load curtailment is they have the high voltage breakers, and when they open those, they take out a lot of our load. It's not very granular, and I think we could do a lot better in the future and plan to.
And Valerie, I was getting those messages, and I believed that the system was in place, that it was coming all the way down to the individual distribution cooperatives, the municipals, to everyone. What did Basin do with the messages as you were getting them from SPP, starting with the 8th or 9th of February, whenever it kind of started?
Those messages were communicated up through our senior staff and team. And I think maybe, Tom, did you reference that you were running load management and receiving communication of some of those messages, but maybe that you weren't getting them directly from SPP during that time frame?
Correct.
Okay.
So just to, this is the first kind of time I'm hearing the granular discussion about who got what information. So just want to make sure I'm understanding it. SPP, the various alerts don't go to the, like, the both Matts didn't get those.
This is Matthew Stolz, Montrilliams again. I got the messages, show up in my email, my work email. So somehow I think I'm subscribed to the list server that Lanny uses to distribute those notices. I'm not sure which list server that is, but they showed up in my personal, not personal, my work email.
And Matt, the other Matt, no?
Yeah, we did not get them. We started getting them on Monday is when our G&T started to get those through the pipeline and send them down. It was on Monday. I think actually at that point in time, Basin was sending them just directly right to all of the distribution co-op managers at that point in time, because I think they were coming right from Basin on
okay
Monday.
So Valerie, you were saying you shared them up to management, but you shared them out to your members too then? Those men. Say that, I didn't hear that.
We shared them up with our senior staff, and then those messages got sent to our Class A members.
Okay.
I would point out that, Central Power is a Class A member base in electric. We are a member of SPP. We're a transmission owner. Our six member cooperatives are not members of SPP. They're members of Central Power.
Sure.
So they're not really in the direct communication path today. But I think the efforts are underway to make sure the WAPAs, the TOP, will communicate that down to whoever wants the information. I know all of our six members are going to want.
What's the downside to spreading this? I mean, it feels like everybody's being kind of stingy with this really important information. What's the downside of getting it to anybody who should know?
If I maybe make a couple comments here, you know, even going back to 2019, I think SPP had moved into conservative operations a number of times. And so it's kind of like the weather warnings, right? There's a severe thunderstorm, might progress to a tornado watch, et cetera. And we'd even been in a number of EEA1s before. But you hear those messages, and I think that was communicated that, yes, we're in a resource alert. Now we're in conservative operations. At times it goes into an EEA1 and nothing's happened. And, you know, we didn't expect, I don't think anybody expected, that it would progress to an EEA2, a 3, and then the ultimate load curtailments. So I think there's a little bit of that. Everything was being communicated, but you hear the message. You know, when I hear tornado warning, if I don't know what a tornado is, what are you going to do? And so I think to a certain extent, and that's part of the communication that Western is working on, is here's these stages and how severe are they and how they progress. And that was part of the issue, I think, too, is that even myself, you know, what are those stages and how severe can it get? Well, we've been here before. We were in a conservative operation a number of times in the past. We were okay. And I think that was one of the issues that happened, is we had been in those situations before. Never load curtailments, but this time things happened and it ultimately led to it. And so I think there's that's part of it as well.
Yeah, and I think, getting all the way down to the distribution side, nobody likes to be continually warning their customers that they're vulnerable. And it's just not something that anybody wants to do. So I can understand that, but I think we've really learned here that we have to recognize these situations too.
Yeah, if the engineers can't decipher that information and know like what means what, and then who can? I mean, that seems to me like the engineers can handle that information and should have it.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those situations, you know it, but never been in load curtailments before, and to a certain extent, we were used to everything being just fine. And we know we get on the edge sometimes, but we've always pulled through. And this time, due to higher loads, fuel supply issues, import limitations, all those things come together. And all of a sudden, you find yourself where you need to be curtailing load to make generation balance usage. One other point, though, too, is that I think it's important to note that what the reason for these curtailments is, when you get into that situation, and I guess as SPP is RC and balancing authority can probably better state, but what you really don't want is any controlled, uncontrolled loss of load. You want to keep control. You want to keep the frequency at 60 hertz. And if the necessity comes that you have to interrupt load to maintain that generation load balance, that's what you want. You don't want to end up in a cascading event. And to SPP's credit and WAPA's credit, that, you know, they kept control.
Thanks. And Lanny, I want to avoid having to answer the same question hundreds of times here when this is all over. And so I think there's also a big misunderstanding in an area like North Dakota that has been a energy exporter for many decades, that we should always be fine because we produce plenty of energy. Within the SPP footprint, which covers states all the way from northern Texas up to North Dakota, when there is a need for load shed, it is spread proportionately with all the among all the transmission operators. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
So I think that is an important thing that North Dakotans need to understand. Most of the time throughout this event, we're producing more energy than what we technically needed, but there could be other times when we don't. And this is the decision that has been made over decades to have these regional transmission organizations. It's a team thing. And so load sheds are shared proportionately. Lloyd, when we're doing load shed events, how do we make sure that we are as responsive or that we're responsive as quickly as possible and yet are able to get proper granularity? What if someone has a switch that controls enormous amounts of customers and their share calls for a little more reduction, how do we prevent from having to shut so much down in order to achieve what's necessary?
Well, hopefully the processes that we're trying to put in place now, where we're going to be talking more ahead of time and laying out some plans for those folks that have the capability to be able to manage this on their own, we're planning to allow them to do that. On Monday, that's basically what we did. We knew there was just a few entities that we could call and tell them to, hey, curtail this amount and you do it, you decide how to do it. The amount that we needed to curtail on Tuesday, and to not just go back to those few entities that we had gone to on Monday and asking them to bear a larger share again on Tuesday. As we went to some of these other entities, we tried to plan ahead of time for, we were expecting, well, maybe we could get 100 to 150 megawatt curtailment. That might be what we would receive or could possibly see on Tuesday, basically double what we saw on Monday. And so that's what we were trying to do and coordinate to with entities ahead of time to see what we could, how to curtail that 150 megawatts. Well, we ended up with two requests of 163 megawatts. So instead of the 150 we were sort of planning for, and when I say planning for it, it's a guess. SPP didn't know how much they're going to be short or if they were going to be short on Tuesday. So we were estimating it could possibly be around 150. It came out to be, over 300. So we quickly went through that 150 and had to move on to others. And we tried, in some instances, we tried calling folks to coordinate it, couldn't get in touch with them, and we just needed to move on and take action. It's something, that we have to do in minutes as opposed to an hour or more. We took the actions that we thought were appropriate at the time. As we're moving forward with our plans now, we're trying to coordinate and setting up plans with folks ahead of time, more detailed plans ahead of time, because just like Tom had mentioned, we have several conservative operation periods, probably dozens of conservative operation periods throughout the year. So that's just like hearing that there's going to be a thunderstorm watch. In the Dakotas, you have that almost every week. So it's, you know, the conservative operations is something that's happening frequently. We've only gone into EEA ones, you know, Tom mentioned a few times. Yeah, it's probably what you can count on one hand, the number of times we've gone into EEA ones within our footprint, going back even to when we were operating it and the balancing authority, you know, going back into the 90s. So for the last 30, 40 years, you know, I'm only aware of us initiating an EEA once, but EEAs are initiated by the balancing authority. And so we've had a few couple while we've been with SPP. So these things don't happen a lot. You know, the comment about, is this secret information that shouldn't be shared? No. And in fact, on our part, it was probably more, we thought it was being shared, and it wasn't. And so that's why we decided we need to take a more proactive role instead of assuming that somebody else is relaying that information that normally has more direct contact with those distribution entities.
And I just want to make sure that I'm understanding this point right, because it's really important to me. Your customers up here, whether they're cooperatives or the municipals, if they have the appropriate equipment and want to take responsibility for making their own decisions on load shed, you will allow them to do that. If they don't have that equipment or don't want to do it, you will maintain it. Is that correct?
That is correct. That's our preference would be that everybody have that capability. So when we got a 6% curtailment like happened on Tuesday, it was a little over 6%. We could look at them and say, yeah, you've got 10, your load's 10 megawatts. You know, you've got to curtail a megawatt and you just keep that off. You know, that would be our desire. We are ultimately responsible to ensure that happens. So we would be watching that. And if we didn't see it happen, we would have to take action. But yeah, as long as they want to do it and they have the capability to do it and they perform those actions, we have no concerns over that. In fact, that would be in our mind the ideal solution, though we realize, you know, that isn't something that everybody out there will be able to do.
And can you keep us informed of which co-ops and municipals are taking on their own responsibility as opposed to WAPA having the first responsibility, or is that confidential?
Let's just say I defer to Basin and the members as their members as to you know, how much of that information they want to relay on.
It's probably not a primary point for this conference either, but
I would my first reaction is the only issue would be with CEII, critical energy infrastructure information. Beyond that, as long as that didn't contain any of that information, or at least we had the appropriate controls, from our perspective, we wouldn't have an issue.
I've been curious as we talk about this load shed issue, are any of you actively seeking more sort of tariff customers who have demand response as one of their like clear assigned, like they're signing up for it, and so they know that we're going to be kicked. We're the first ones to get kicked off, and we are prepared for that. Just that seems to be a bigger conversation that's happening nationally, that, you know, there may be a fair number of customers out there who are willing to take a little lower rate and then be the first ones kicked off in times of need like this. Are any of you actively pursuing that?
I would say Montreal Ooms is investigating that, because you're exactly right. Perhaps we could get some rate relief for these customers if they cut their demand during peak times, not just for reliability, but when you shave your peak, it's less demand that Basin has to cover, less resources they have to acquire. So it saves everybody some money. So yeah, we're investigating that.
Okay, and I want to wrap up this section with you two from Montreal Williams and McKenzie with just another opportunity. If there's anything that you would like to add, and I pick you two out specifically because of the enormous amount of load that you have up there, its impact on the oil patch, and frankly, as the decisions are being made, if for example, the one that in McKenzie's area where the large gas plant went down for a long time, well, then that cascade, then does that mean that some electric generator didn't get gas and so it caused us to have to shed even more load? Or what did that do to the other people we regulate, the gas companies that are heating people's homes? What did it do to their rates and such? So you've heard, we've had good discussion with Mr. Linke, others at the table. Anything else you want to add on the load shed issue?
Well, I guess from a philosophical perspective, 10, 15 years ago, Montreal was just a 30 megawatt co-op. Then the Bakken hit, and suddenly 10 years later, Montreal is a 500 megawatt co-op. So it's a whole different business model. And Montreal decided to I guess, kind of grow up, if you will, and adopted a network service perspective, brought WAPA in to operate the 115 system they built throughout their service territory. Montreal joined SPP as a transmission owner. I think that was one of the reasons I was getting those energy alerts, is because I'm participating in the SPP process. So I guess my recommendation or my conclusion is that having Montreal step up and join the big boys, if you will, in the transmission owner realm in SPP paid off, that we had good communications with WAPA as our transmission operator. We had direct communications with SPP as well. And also we had that granular control of our load because we had so many delivery points that we're able to reach remotely through our SCADA system. That's all. Thank you.
Anything else, Matt? Matt Manson?
I think everything's been said very well, but the big takeaway is I think communication is of the utmost in this type of event. I also would say, just on the comment of who controls the load, it's probably really infeasible to think that WAPA is going to know what load is on each one of the delivery points that they serve, or at least the distribution co-ops. Those are changing a lot. You never know what load they're going to switch. So at least for McKenzie's purpose, we have, and we would like to continue to have that control over how we manage our system and our members, because we know best. We're in tune with those members. The biggest thing is that good communication up front so that we can make really good decisions on how we approach the request at hand. I think that's the key part. And then having continual dialogue. I know it was a very fluid situation through the whole roughly 2 or 3 day event of different generators coming on, different generators going off, and really trying to have as much communication as possible. I personally took a stance where every hour, I'm sure the Watertown dispatch folks probably got tired of seeing my number call in, but I called every hour to WAPA and said, what is the current situation? Because that visibility of, actually there's a really nice graph that I came to find out that WAPA keeps up that shows what load, and I think it probably comes from SPP, but what loads, what's the demand on the system versus what is available? And you can actually start at least making some assumptions as to how the system is reacting, and therefore take some proactive measures on your side, whether it's messaging with members or whether it is actually taking some sort of action. But it's all about sharing that communication and making sure and information so that you can make good, educated decisions to hopefully offset a load shed or curtailment event.
Never worry. I'm sure Mr. Linke and his team never tire of hearing from you.
Yeah. They did a great, they were very helpful in the middle of the battle. So, yep.
Madam Chair, could we take our break 15 minutes early and leave a little more. I think that the resource adequacy thing might be more time constrained. And then if it's not, we can even come back to more on these questions. But
sure. Did you want to check with staff on these questions?
There was nothing.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm good with that. So you want to take a break right now and we'll be back at 10:15? Perfect. All right, everyone. We'll see you in 15 minutes.
So we wrapped up those first three questions and even left ourselves an extra 15 minutes to talk about resource adequacy. And that was not by accident. And so I appreciate everyone's willingness to answer questions succinctly this morning. And we'll continue to do that. I'm going to tell you on the panel that a lot of my questions in this area are going to be for SPP and probably for Basin Electric as generator. So, and to me, we can kind of combine the fourth and fifth questions here. It's about resource adequacy, but then also what's North Dakota's role in resource adequacy in any areas where it might differ from everyone's role in general. I'm going to say, Lanny, that I'll address this first to you in the responses to some of our questions. And by the way, we had sent out some similar questions to both SPP and MISO in advance, and I really appreciate both RTOs' responses. But I felt like SPP's responses were overly cautious when delivering estimates, or else they're very surprising to me, one of the two. But I look at one of the questions was the expected nameplate capacity of various generation sources in 2031. And I see not really much change from where we're at in 2021. And I am expecting a lot more change than this. So I don't know if this was based on what is specifically and certainly announced, or if you really believe that for example, there won't be any more wind added in the next decade. Tell me a little bit about your expectations for the generation capacity in SPP footprint.
Well, certainly, and Commissioner, I will tell you that the information we provided is based on information provided to us when we perform our information gathering exercise for the resource adequacy program that we administer. And really, the information that is sought for resource adequacy purposes focuses primarily on next year and then the 4 years after that. So it's really a five-year analysis with the primary focus being on the upcoming year. I can tell you based on planning or transmission planning studies that the expectations we include in those futures that are being studied are a lot more aggressive, perhaps, than the certain information that is provided for resource adequacy purposes. And you know, look, I expect that a lot of our members are just telling us what they know for certain now and don't want to include potential type information. If you look at our queue, and I mentioned this earlier, of, you know, we've got 100,000 megawatts of resources in our queue, with the majority of that being solar. A lot of it continues to be wind, and we're seeing a growing amount of battery storage. I fully expect that as much of that can come online will. Typically speaking, in the past, we've seen somewhere between 40 and at times up to 80% of that generation drop out of the queue. So, you know, clearly I'm not going to tell you that we're going to see 100,000 megawatts. But it wouldn't surprise me if we didn't see another 5 to 10,000 more wind. It wouldn't surprise me if we didn't see, you know, within the next 10 years or so, a fairly significant amount of solar. Right now, we don't have a lot of solar, but I expect that we will see more. And it wouldn't surprise me to see a lot of storage. The exact amounts at this point are purely a guess, because when those developers enter the queue, they're making decisions based on the transmission cost and the cost of them to interconnect and whether or not they can find somebody to buy the output of their product. So that's about all I can tell you, Commissioner Chrisman. Now, just based on what I'm seeing in the queue, there's certainly potential for a lot more renewables and battery storage type generation to be added. By the same token, you know, since 2014, we've seen, I think, about 6,000 megawatts of coal coal and gas retirements. And I think it's safe to assume that we're going to see more of that unless and until there are expectations placed by somebody somewhere as to what the minimum amount is that's needed to preserve reliability. But if left up to the utilities and it's simply a financial decision, we either need to add market signals to keep, you know, enough generation that provides the right attributes, or we need to place minimum expectation requirements for resource adequacy purposes.
Is there anything SPP can do to get a better vision from the entities doing business in the footprint of what's coming a few years out? It makes it very hard to plan for resource adequacy when there's so much uncertainty about what resources are going to be available.
Well, you know, I mean, we can certainly continue to do what we've done, which is to ask for the information. You know, beyond that, I don't know. I don't have an answer for you, Commissioner. I don't know how to, you know, because a lot of these decisions are being made based on economics, and a lot of these decisions are kept pretty confidential until the utilities are ready to make it a little more public, and they're very cautious about doing that.
And so am I wrong in thinking that an RTO actually incentivizes or discourages the development of the non-dispatchable competitors coming into the market by how it's going to accredit that resource? If you're going to accredit them higher, they're going to be more likely to enter the market, and lower, they will be less likely. Is that correct?
Well, there's certainly some truth to that. To the extent, you know, the cost benefit equation doesn't play out to support adding a resource that doesn't give you a whole lot of accredited capacity, I would expect, you know, the right economic decisions to be made in that regard. But we continue to see a lot of it being added, and there is recognition that the capacity that can be accredited for those additional renewable resources isn't quite as good or as much as other more conventional generation. Now, there's a lot of factors that contribute to that, and some of those factors are just, you know, political pressures. There's consumer pressures. A lot of consumers are in the footprint and want to enter the footprint because of our low prices, and those consumers have certain expectations for clean energy. And so I'm giving you my perspective. It's certainly not necessarily indicative of what every utility is thinking and what they're doing, but it's just based on things that I hear and see in writing.
And so when I was looking at some of the numbers based on nameplate capacity and then the accreditation percentage, especially on Monday, wind did not live up to its accredited value in the footprint. Coal didn't live up to its accredited value in the footprint. But they were in the ballpark. Gas, I think, was less than half of its accredited value. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I mean, you're pretty close, Commissioner. I will tell you, from the perspective of wind, the amount of energy produced by the wind generation in the footprint came really close to matching the accredited capacity for the footprint. However, it turns out that about half of that energy that was produced from wind resources was from accredited resources. So not every resource that was producing energy at that time, while we were thankful to get it, was from an accredited resource. In other words, it could have been non-firm energy. Again, we were thankful to have it, but just to be fair and to be as accurate as I can be, it is true that from the accredited resources supplying wind energy, about half of what was accredited actually produced. Gas was even worse, a little less than half of what is accredited produced energy. And coal, you know, from the perspective of what was accredited, coal performed better than the others, but even it didn't show up at its accredited value.
And so is the message there, and I've been focused a lot on the communication side of it, but certainly watching resource adequacy closely, but is SPP's whole accreditation process one of the things that are being reviewed?
Absolutely.
As part of the learning process from February?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the other thing that's been pointed out earlier, these accreditation values and our reserve margin requirements are based on summertime expectations. And let me just elaborate a little bit on that. For example, if you are wanting to claim your gas plant or your coal plant or your wind generator as accredited capacity for the summertime, you have to demonstrate that it's going to be available. You can't take an outage, for example, during the summer months that are important for accreditation and for our reserve margin requirement. In the wintertime, though, because we don't really have a winter accreditation policy in place yet, there's no expectation currently that those generators can't take outages. And so I think that it's got to be part of the conversation. We've got to consider that. We've got to figure out what it is we need in the wintertime. And we got to make sure that the accreditation policies that are in place or put in place for wintertime usage can appropriately assure that what we need in the wintertime will be there.
Okay, and I think Commissioner Fedorchak has a question, but before I pass it on, I want to make a statement and just see if you have a response to it. But to me, the one of the key things that SPP does is the transmission planning. And at RSC specifically, the resource adequacy. And we have got to somehow, I think, get a better long-term grasp of what our generation mix that's available to us is going to be in order to do those things well. Did you want to respond to that, or am I?
Oh, right? Yeah. I'm sorry. I thought you were just making a statement.
I was, but I'm just wondering if if there's disagreement.
No. No, not at all. The RSC, again, I mentioned earlier, the Regional State Committee does have delegated authority for resource adequacy, and I agree wholeheartedly.
Your entry is not valid.
The RSC, and really for the organization to perform well, we do have to have not just data, but information, and that information has to be credible, and it's got to be appropriate for the time frames that we're considering. I mean, you know, when we talk about transmission planning, there's a reason we do a study 10 years out in the future, and it's because it takes 8 to 10 years to build transmission. It doesn't take quite as long to build generation. And that's primarily why we focused on just getting 5 years worth. But if we need to look beyond that and we need to get better information, then certainly I expect that's got to be part of the solution.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
You maybe hit on the answer to this just now, but I'll ask it earlier in your one of your first statements after the break. You said something to the effect of when somebody, until the time that, you know, somebody tells us what the right mix needs to be or what the generation mix needs to be to keep reliable, you know, to keep the reliability up. You posed it like you're not sure who that is, who should be doing that. So whose job is that to tell you or the any RTO what your system needs to be reliable?
Well, I think on behalf of SPP, I want SPP to step up and do that. And I'll give you an example of where we've done that, something similar before. When the Clean Power Plan was proposed, I want to say back in 2014, SPP as an RTO, even though it wasn't written in our duties and our responsibilities, SPP stepped up, performed an analysis, and we focused on reliability. And we said, you know, we're not going to weigh in on the environmental aspects of the Clean Power Plan, but we are going to weigh in on the reliability aspects. And what we told the EPA at that time is in order to do this reliably, you need a transition that gives us more time so that we can prepare for it and make sure that the transmission is in place to accommodate it. I think we need to do something very similar here. We need to step up and we need to demonstrate and evaluate, even if we have no real ability to control the outcome, but we need to, at least not yet, we need to make sure that at least our members and our regulators understand the resource mix, or at least the attributes of that resource mix that are needed for reliability reasons.
So, okay, very good. So you mentioned that, if I could just one more follow up, you mentioned that you have quite a lot of battery in the queue. Do you have much experience working with the batteries yet? And if so, or if not, I'm curious how you know how they perform, so you know what kind of attributes you need to be building around to support the integration of widespread, you know, batteries.
It's a fair question. We don't currently have. The amount of storage that we have on our system today is negligible, and so we don't have any real-time experience with it. The studies that we are doing in terms of laying out the expectations of how it will perform in our loss of load expectation studies, and since this is a technical workshop, I'll again mention the effective load carrying capability analysis, which just tells you what you can expect to see when you need it the most. We're basing those on information we have available to us, but we certainly don't have any real-time experience with that yet.
If I could just kind of close with a statement like Commissioner Crispin did. If from my perspective, the RTOs have to get more vocal about what the system can and cannot do. You are the only people who have that information and know it. So if you aren't saying anything, I think the assumption is that these plans can be accomplished and you'll figure out how to do it. And I say the same thing to my so on a regular basis. We have to hear from you. And that isn't, I would urge you that doesn't mean that you, in doing so, are taking a political stance for or against anything. You're the engineers, you're the, you know, impartial system people who everyone is counting on to keep the system reliable. And so I just urge you to get more aggressive in your efforts to speak up and say, here's what we need, here's how we need it, here's the pathway. You know, I think everyone recognizes this is a transition time and that we need to build in maybe some additional redundancies and time and some elasticity in the system when we're expecting it to perform with new things that are untested and unproven yet. So I hope that SPP gets really active in this space. And again, I'm urging MISO in the same way.
Well, Commissioner, I couldn't agree with you more. And, I want to also make sure you're not left with the impression we haven't done anything. We have done some of these studies in the past, and at least we focused on certain aspects of those types of analysis. But I do think we're going to have to get louder and clearer about those kinds of analysis and make sure that the information is well understood and that it gets in the right hands.
I didn't intend to go down this avenue today, but it just seems like the perfect time to address something that has been irritating me for several years. But when it comes to like this being a technical conference, most everybody in this room understands a lot of this stuff. A good part of the population, I think we all agree, does not have a great grasp of technicalities of running an electric grid. And with the markets as they are, it is clear that in the middle of the night, with moderate temperatures and high winds across the footprint, that the wind generation industry is going to dominate that market. It's just how it's set up. And I would never suggest that we not be transparent and hide the facts, because that is a fact. But when the RTO goes out of its way to send out tweets about that hitting some new capacity level that, oh, you know, we just hit 80-some% of the market provided by wind energy, what a good part of the population hears, and frankly, a lot of decision makers and policymaking branches here, is it's 2021 and we can already cover 80% of our energy needs with wind. So having 100% by 2030 will be easy. Want to respond?
Well, yes, I do. And I will tell you that we have taken pride over the last several years in, as an organization, being able to reliably incorporate the renewables that we've been able to do. And we've always tried to be careful to explain that the reason we're able to do that is, one, because we've, as an organization, our members have invested over $10 billion in transmission assets and infrastructure. Two, we have a geographically diverse footprint and fuel diversity that helps us achieve those results. And then we have systems and tools with a market that spans 14 states. And so we're proud of that fact, but I get it. I understand that. In fact, I was told the other day, not by somebody in North Dakota, that we're being tone deaf. And so I think that's what I'm hearing from you as well, at least to some extent, that, you know, that the messaging that we are producing is creating expectations that may not be well informed.
So that's a fair amount of discussion to digest. Tom or Valerie, Jean, I'm going to come to you next. Any thoughts on what you've heard so far?
No, I think this is good discussion. I think as we talk a little bit more about resource adequacy and what those, how it gets evaluated, what the capability of the generation is to meet loads when you need it. I think that's all good discussion. And again, I'm going to come back to the fuel supply adequacy issue. I think that, in, at least in my mind, is paramount to solving it. If you're gonna solve the issue, you have to correctly identify what the problem was. And again, final reports are not out yet. I think there's still analysis to be done. But this fuel supply adequacy issue, at least in my from my point of view, is primary.
Commissioner, can I tack on a little bit to what Mr. Christensen said?
Sure.
You know, Tom is exactly right. Unfortunately, what SPP can't control at all, and even really can't control the generation assets that we have in our footprint, but just on a limited basis, we have no control over the fuel. And if we talk about gas, we would love to see some federal direction coming that would enable improved coordination between the gas industry and the electric industry. But that's not something we can control today. So I think what we can do, though, is better understand what that fuel supply issue is and make sure that those assumptions are incorporated correctly in the analysis that we can perform and in the expectations that we can control.
Okay, I'm thinking about that. I think Valerie had something to say before you.
Thank you, Commissioner. So I do agree with the things that have been mentioned in terms of resource adequacy. And just to keep in mind, as we think of resource adequacy, there's always two values that a generator provides. And it's a capacity value and an energy value. And the energy value, I think, is really what we're trying to focus on and trying to make sure we have enough of that in the market to be able to respond at the right times. We talked about the 80% wind to load penetration, and that's absolutely helpful when we're trying to serve our load at a low cost, and we like to take advantage of that. But the other thing that does introduce is a lot of volatility in market prices. And when we see a lot of volatility in market prices, our generators are trying to dispatch around that pricing volatility. And it's fairly easy for a peaking, a gas peaking unit to run for an hour, to start up, run for an hour and turn off, or maybe start up and run for the on-peak hours. But when you start to talk about coal generation, it's a little bit more difficult to run for an hour at a time, or even just 8 hours or during the day. So that's one of the areas that we definitely are challenged with, is when we look at generation and trying to remain viable with our dispatchable generation. And we're looking to the market to provide products to compensate these resources for the services they do provide. So some of the products that we've supported in development of through the marketplace are various types of ramping products. When the wind moves, you need resources that can ramp up or ramp down and provide that service to move around the wind. So we've asked for, not just Basin, but the market participants in total have asked for products and worked with SPP to develop a compensation mechanism to pay coal resources, gas resources, and even wind resources for providing that ramping capability when it's needed. There's a couple different ramping products that are coming into the market later this year and in the next coming year. Another thing that we have worked with the market on is trying to understand more transparency, more pricing transparency as we go into the next few days to see if our coal unit or our coal generation, because those generators need to run at a longer than 24 hours at a stretch once we start them up. And so we're trying to understand greater pricing transparency as we move forward in time to understand if it's going to be a viable time frame to run a generator like that. That's something that the market has responded with in terms of a multi-day price forecast. That's something that's going live here in the near future that will be a little bit more helpful to us to understand how to run some of our generators. There's also fast start resource enhancements that are coming into play that compensate some of the resources that can start up within 10 minutes. So largely, we're looking for these products that can help provide more revenue to some of these resources that can have a greater likelihood of providing the energy when we need it.
And I've wondered when I read about these products. So are we talking about something built into the integrated marketplace to reward entities that have these characteristics?
Yes.
And so do they then just compensate the owners of those facilities some certain amount per year or per month? Or does that mean that you go through the auction that is the integrated market, and when that owner gets the bid to produce energy, whatever it is, that you get something a little more than what that bid was because you have those characteristics? I don't understand how that would be paid.
Sure. So every day in the, well, first of all, there's the registration process where you have all, SPP has over 800 resources that have to register with the market and let the market know what kind of services they would be available to provide. The market does various forms of testing to validate that these resources can indeed provide those services. And then on a daily basis, each market participant has the opportunity to offer in their generation. And when you offer in your generation, you can offer in energy, which would be the most common form of, maybe most common service that a resource would get paid for. And you tell the market, okay, this is how much it costs to produce my energy at each of these points. But not only can you let the market know that you can provide energy with the resource, you can also let the market know that, hey, I can provide a ramping service for the market, and this is how much it costs me to do that. I can provide a regulation up or a regulation down service, and that would be responding to like 5-second pulses in different energy needs. I can provide a spinning reserve service where I can maybe sit at a lower level of my generation, but be able to provide that generator to move up X number of megawatts if the market calls on it and needs it. So every day when we submit our resources into the market, we let the market know this is how much it costs us to do each of these things. And when the market captures all this information from all the market participants and they run the big computer model to solve it, they spit out the most co-optimized answer that gives us the most value for our resources, but also provides the lowest cost of production with all those services included for the whole market. There's already...
Victor.
There's already some of these, what they're called as ancillary services, so services other than energy, that go through this process. And those are the things that I mentioned, like regulation or spinning reserves.
So do you feel like we're the generators that are interested in this are making progress in moving SPP's marketplace forward with adopting the products that you feel are needed?
Yeah, I think there's some progress, absolutely.
Good progress or just some?
Good progress.
Good. Tom from Central Power, I know you're not a generator, but I just kick it over to you. Do you have anything?
What Val said.
Okay. Co-optimized answers, right?
So something that's kind of plagued me for a number of years too with all of this is, so we're adding all these new market products out there to bring forward the attributes that are needed. Is there a way to look at it that would basically change up the way the market is, the foundations of the market, which is, I think SPP is the same. You pay on fuel cost. You know, the market price is based on your fuel cost. And so that worked great for decades when everybody had a fuel cost. And and kind of brought forward the same attributes. So there wasn't a big distinction between one generation type versus another generation type. But now today is completely different, and it's probably going to continue to grow more and more different as new technologies like batteries are going to perform different than nuclear are going to perform different than wind, so are the market operators just taking a step back and looking at that? Does this make sense to just keep layering on to a system that's kind of fundamentally broken? And could we be looking at it a different way? And how complicated would that be? Or would it have payoffs over time? Have you guys had these conversations in your worlds? And what do they, what are the options out there?
So you're absolutely right, Commissioner, that the costs that are captured in the offer, so when we let the market know the cost of all our energy or the cost of our services, those costs are based on very variable type costs for the unit, largely fuel, but they can also include some other variable type costs. One of the advances that has been made in the market over the last few years is in terms of long-term maintenance costs. Prior to this being implemented, and I think it was maybe about 3 years ago, we didn't have the ability to submit long-term maintenance costs for generators into the market, into our offers, because they weren't necessarily those variable type costs. But one of the changes that has been made is that if we can prove that we have costs that are based on a start or based on run hours, which is what we see oftentimes with our natural gas units, that we do have the ability to capture those costs in our mitigated offer structures. So there's been some discussion and some advancement. It's not a total blanket where we can include any type of costs that we'd like in those offers, but there has been some advancement in that area.
But you don't want to include costs. If you want your unit to run, you want it to be cheaper, right? So that kind of exacerbates the problem.
It's a difficult line to balance in terms of which kind of costs you want to include and when you want to include them. The market structure allows you the ability to do so in your mitigated offer. You don't have to. So there is some flexibility in how you want to strategize and think about the offer costs that you have.
Curious, Lanny, do you have any thoughts on this?
I would add to what Valerie said earlier in terms of ancillary services. One of the things that we studied recently is what we've referred to as essential reliability services. And while we haven't yet implemented those products into the market design yet, it is on our plan, or is included in our plan to do so. But that could also value aspects or attributes of generation that aren't currently being valued today.
Can you say that again? Value things that are currently being valued today?
That aren't being explicitly
valued.
Yeah, in the market design today.
And how would those be? How would that work?
Well, I don't know that we've figured out the details of how that would work yet, but at least conceptually, if we know we need a certain amount of inertia and we know we need a certain amount of resilience to be determined what that amount is, and generators who have those capabilities are incented to offer those as a service and then are paid for those, then, the hope is and the expectation would be that SPP would more reliably be ready to and be capable to respond to the needs when they materialize. So, Valerie talked about ramping, and ramping is a huge need at times, particularly as you incorporate more renewables that are variable. But there's other things that are kind of fundamental reliability services that used to be provided by a much larger portion of the fleet that may not be provided by a lot of these newer technologies. And so the question is how do we value those such that there's an incentive for the generators that have those capabilities to stay on the grid? And that's a study we've performed, and I know that the market working group that Valerie sits on and participates in has seen that, and I know some of our other committees have seen the output of that report. But now we got to figure out how to implement it.
So if what I hear you saying, and I'm probably taking this a little differently than you envisioned, but that this would kind of be these basic needs of the system would sort of be a foundation that you would be paying for all the time, and then you'd build around that. Is that sort of the market structure I'm hearing you describe?
Generally speaking, yes. Again, a lot of the details have yet to be figured out in terms of how we would incorporate it into the market design, but that would be philosophically the expectation.
Interesting.
And Valerie, feel free to add based on what you've heard and seen in the market working group discussions.
Yeah, maybe just to add on to that one more time, the products that we talked about, whether they be the essential reliability services that Lanny mentioned, or the ramping products, or the fast start resources, whatever the additional product that's being developed is, all of the needs for those products would differ based on the type of generation that would be available in the market for that given hour. For example, if there wasn't any wind in the market in an hour, you probably wouldn't have a lot of need for a quick ramping product, because you'd have other resources that would be online, be able to provide energy, and wouldn't need to move up or move down in response to wind. So those products would be available when they were needed based on the type of resources that were in the market for that given hour, or that given 5 minutes, or given day, or whatever the time frame is that SPP would be solving for.
And the other thing I would say about that is, there's always a debate about whether or not it's enough to just have market incentives, or do you also need minimum requirements? We can talk about other market designs, and there's one to the south of us that they really don't even have a minimum requirement for reserve margin. They expect that the market design will incentivize that. Whereas we have a minimum requirement. And so in terms of essential reliability services and certain types of attributes, what we've been talking about so far, at least over the last 5 or 10 minutes, is relying on a market design to incentivize that. And I think the question is still fair to be asked. And this is where I talked about our responsibility. We may need to do more than just a market design feature. Mm-hmm. We may need to develop some minimum expectations for those attributes that are required to be available. Whether the market uses them or not is a secondary issue at that point.
That's interesting. I like that comparison, because those are two very different approaches. So Valerie, what you described are like short-term signals, it seems to me, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. You're not going to get, that's not viable for the nuclear facilities and the coal facilities to respond that quickly. So it seems like you're kind of, again, incentivizing more natural gas. And I think, at least in the interim, we are seeing an over-dependence on that one fuel source. So are you potentially exacerbating the problem with those very market products?
Sure. Thank you for the follow-up question. Maybe I should describe it a little bit more clearly. There are a couple different market mechanisms that the units go through in order to get committed or started up, and then to ultimately get dispatched. There is a day ahead market where the market looks at a resource for the terms of the next 24 hours to determine if they need that resource in the market. or if they will continue to need that resource in the market. So there's always a day ahead 24-hour type period. And I think the market even looks beyond that, but only publishes the first 24 hours for market participants to understand if they would be committed in the next day market. What I was referring to in terms of a 5-minute response is every 5 minutes in the real-time market. So for example, as we speak, all of the resources that are online are getting dispatched by SPP in order to respond to needs of load and then responses and any other generation changes that are happening. So the resources are getting committed for a longer period of time by the market. And then in addition to that, market participants always have the opportunity to self-commit a unit. And when you self-commit a unit, you can run for as long as you'd like. The downside of that is you are a price taker when you are self-committing the unit.
And so with this discussion of these products and changing the marketplace, Paul or Lanny, in the tariff, does SPP have some flexibility built in for doing some of these things? Or when we contemplate these things, are we looking at products that we first have to agree on and then piece by piece have it approved by FERC as well?
Commissioner, I think it would be the latter. Now, there may be some things that we have some flexibility built into the tariff that we could rely upon and use to achieve some of this, but I would expect that for the most part, if we're talking about a new service and a rate associated with that, that would have to be approved by the commission in order for us to implement it.
Okay. Mr. Linke, a lot of times we forget that you're a energy generator as well, and here in North Dakota with your hydro, it's been one of the most dependable generators to my knowledge that we have. And also, if I'm understanding correctly, has the additional feature that we don't talk about a lot, but the black start feature even. And so you've been listening attentively. Any thoughts on what we've discussed here the last hour or so?
Well, I agree with everything that's been said. The essential reliability services and some of these additional products as the resource mix changes is something that is definitely going to need to be looked at and provided. I've been a past chair of the NERC Operating Committee, and I know that was one of the primary things while I was chair that we were looking at was the essential reliability services, and that those were ancillary services, if you want to say, that really weren't included in the original 888 open access tariffs. And it's something that we've come to realize that is essential for the reliable operation of the bulk electric system. So I agree with those comments. I agree with the ramping product and the fact that, you know, we need to come to grasp with the fact that some of the different resources have different characteristics, and you just can't unplug one and plug one another one in without having to make some different changes. Their characteristics are different, and you just can't take a 500 megawatt coal plant and replace it with a 500 megawatt battery or solar or wind. They have different characteristics, and we just need to come to grasp with those different characteristics and adjust our planning such that we can operate reliably. It may, like I said, you just can't pull one 500 megawatt unit and plug in a different 500 megawatt unit and have the same characteristics and the same impact on the bulk electric system and be able to operate it reliably the same way. So it's not to say that you can't change it, but you're going to, the characteristics are different. And so you may need to have more nameplate capacity, or it may not provide this particular essential reliability service. So you need to make sure it's being procured somewhere else. So I believe we can operate the system reliably, but we have to concentrate on the differences in the characteristics and make sure that we have planning procedures to be able to deal with those different characteristics.
Thank you. Matt or Paul, you guys have boots on the ground dealing with customers, not necessarily generation, but your thoughts on what you've heard here since the break?
I think Lanny mentioned it a little bit, but the one thing that we can't lose sight of is the transmission infrastructure. So we can have all the generators connected, but if you can't get the power to where it needs to be, then it's useless. So I think we have to be mindful that it takes time to build that infrastructure. And part of the challenge right now, I know, is just getting the power to where it needs to be. And there'll be different constraints that'll be imposed. And so we got to make sure that as we think about what generation, what fuel sources, the ability to get it to where it needs to be needs to follow right in part, or else all this effort will lose sight of one piece of the equation.
And you made a great point, and I think we all know it, but often, like during the February event, it's easily lost track of, is the fact that someone has to actually pay for all this stuff at the end of the day. As the energy grid has evolved, in especially these last 10 years, and so we put up new types of generation somewhere else from where the old one was, where there already was transmission and easements were in place and those types of things, does it seem like you're getting a lot of costs passed on to you to not really improve the grid any, but to just change it from one form of generation to another, and thus requiring more transmission?
So I'm not sure I'm the best one to answer that question, particularly maybe look more to Basin or SPP for some of that. But I mean, it all goes down to, there's always additional costs. The more regulations that we put in, it always has a cost component to it. I mean, it's just kind of what happens. Whether it's the cost of compliance, whether it's the cost of fuel, all of those things, impart some sort of cost. And at the end of the day, that goes into whatever that megawatt is that for us is what we, what our membership may see. So it's a dynamic situation that I think you got to look at it eyes wide open, and you got to look at it basically on all parts of every part of what it takes to put that, what it takes to make that megawatt and what it takes to deliver that megawatt.
And while we're in the northeast corner of the room and the northwest corner of the state, Matt Stoltz, anything else to add?
Yeah, I thought I'd touch on something that hasn't been mentioned yet, but it's the bureaucratic environment that we live in when it comes to adding generation. The transmission folks and the generation folks are really not allowed to talk to each other because of the FERC standards of conduct rules. So when Lanny mentions he has 100,000 megawatts of generation queued up, there's no contact between the folks making those generation requests and the transmission planners. That's somewhat forbidden, certainly discouraged because of the FERC rules. So people think there's some kind of collaboration going on between those two fields of engineering, and really there's maybe internally to the network customers there is, but in the market type generation requests, there's not. So it causes a lot of confusion. And back when I was doing transmission planning work, we'd get these generation interconnection requests from third-party wind type people typically, and you'd wonder what the heck are they doing tying to that location, and really we're not allowed to provide any feedback. Secondly is the queuing process itself. SPP opens a window once a year for all these requests to be processed. Then they turn their crank on these studies and they create a transmission solution, and they allocate the cost to the folks that submitted their interconnection requests in that window. Most of the time, well, maybe not most of the time, but a lot of the time, those folks will choke on those costs and drop out. Now, suddenly you've got a study you did that maybe looked at 10,000 megawatts of wind, and now and you have an answer for a transmission answer to accommodate that 10,000 megawatts of wind or solar or whatnot. Now suddenly you only have 2,000 megawatts left. So in other words, your transmission solution is immediately obsolete. So you have to go back and restudy it again with the folks that remained in the process. It's just a continual iterative process. It's really super inefficient and bogs down the study of this generation additions. And that's not SPP's fault. That's a fault of FERC for setting up the standards of conduct and separation of functions between generation interconnections and transmission planning. So I'll throw a little grenade out there for folks to chew on.
Well, that's really interesting. Is there I think there's a fee to apply to get into the queue, is there not? And I guess that then, assuming there is it too low that we encourage the kind of thing that Matt was just talking about?
So I'll take that one, Commissioner. Yes, there is a fee, and there are security requirements that that the customers have to post in order to be able to continue into the different phases of the process. And you know, this is a challenging and complex problem that just has to be solved. And so far, we haven't figured out how to solve it, but we're working diligently trying to solve it. And so I don't know. We've talked about increasing the security requirements and the fees, and I expect that in July we'll propose a solution along those lines. We have an effort underway that we refer to as the Strategic and Creative Reengineering of Integrated Planning Team. That's a long way to say SCRIPT, which is the acronym for that effort, but those folks, and I think Tom is on the group, we're trying to figure out how to really overhaul the transmission planning process. And I think Matt hit the nail on the head. Part of the problem is we don't have a central, or at least a more centralized way to tie the generation planning and the transmission planning together. That's not, I mean, SPP, for example, while we do the transmission planning on behalf of the region, we have no authority or obligation for generation planning. That occurs in a much more spread out fashion. And then we have developers who just simply want to be in the market. And so whatever rules we come up with are going to affect both load serving entities who have a responsibility to procure generation to serve their load and to meet the reserve margin requirement, as well as developers. And so we just have to be very careful how we proceed, because it's going to, a broad brush is going to hit everybody, and it hits them either the right way or the wrong way. And we just have to be very careful as we consider those improvements.
Interesting. Commissioner Crashus.
Lanny, you may have answered the question that I did have, but I'll be a little more pointed because it's been something I've been thinking about, jotted down about before the break. But with a multitude of different state policies out there, and I should phrase this, as we go through the conversation, we're talking about the different entities, the different players at the table, those of you on the panel. State commissions, including North Dakota, can't be held harmless in this process as well. So if there are recommendations on how we can do our job better, I would welcome those comments and would want to hear that as well. But the one thing that seems to be an underlying theme, and this would be for MISO as well when it's their turn, but do you essentially feel as if you're a generation taker, Lanny? These generating assets are proposed, approved. Maybe you have some degree of control on interconnection costs, but not to be sarcastic, do you ever look at some of these coming in and say, thanks a lot, Now we have to figure this out on the transmission side.
Yes, sir. I mean, you hit it really squarely on the head, Commissioner. We have no way to dictate currently where generation is placed. Even if we knew where it should be placed, we have no ability to inform. And we would love to. I mean, some of the ideas we've talked about is includes providing more information to generation developers as to where they could locate more optimally. And every time we talk about that idea, there's a lot of, because it's a very competitive market. It's the same thing on the load side. I mean, I would love to be able to inform load where they could connect and add more load to the system as cheaply as possible. But you've got multiple utilities. They're all competing with each other. And we don't yet have that ability to help inform the market. And so as a result of that, we often are just simply a taker of what we can get. And, you know, then our job simply becomes to make sure that whatever we are given is reliably incorporated. And we do that through the transmission planning process.
Okay. I wanted to get Matt and Matt. Paul, did you have anything to add from the distribution company's perspective?
Not really, no. I just a general comment. I liked Commissioner Fedorchak's point about everybody getting more vocal and taking the opportunity to take the recent crisis and utilizing it to improve while we can and while the topic is fresh. But no, I don't have anything more from the distribution level.
In our questionnaires that we sent out that I had alluded to earlier, there was a sentence in here that I'll just read the whole thing. SPP's integrated marketplace allows SPP to dispatch the most reliable and lowest cost generation to meet the load in the SPP footprint. Val, with all the thought that you've given to the changes in the marketplace that are needed and the new products that you've talked about, at this point in time, does the integrated marketplace really dispatch the most reliable and lowest cost, or is it pretty much just the lowest cost?
There are various processes that the market goes through in terms of committing resources, which means starting them up, making sure they're online, and then ultimately dispatching the resources. But beyond that, there are also processes that the operators, the market operators, are looking through to make sure that we are also reliably, on top of that, reliably making sure that we are serving our load. There's various studies that go on throughout the day where there's additional reviews to ensure that this is happening. As well as some other oversight that can provide maybe manual or other sort of direction in terms of generators that maybe need to run. So yes, I do believe the market is reliably and economically dispatching generation in terms of what we're able to provide to them in terms of the economics of our resources or the costs of our resources on a variable basis. Like was mentioned earlier, I think we've only been in an EEA one status one time prior to the event in February, which would indicate to me that the market has been reliable prior to that.
So I think I'm thinking of reliability long term, and your answer is maybe for more shorter term. There was only one EA event before, but until just the last year or two, there had been almost no times of conservative operations, and it's becoming more and more frequent, all this stuff. And so when I asked the question, I didn't ask it very well, But is this marketplace as it exists today really rewarding the generators that have the long-term and consistent reliability features, or is it mostly rewarding the ones that don't, the cheapest?
I understand your question. In terms of ensuring that the generators can remain viable going forward, there are a lot of costs beyond the variable costs that the market sees and the market dispatches the generation based on. There's costs like staffing, there's costs like long-term maintenance that aren't necessarily start-based or run-hour based. And yes, it's absolutely difficult to recover all of those types of costs through the market mechanism. And it is even more difficult with lower prices that are created by renewable generation or created by low gas prices. Those two things are driving market prices lower. So the amount of revenue that comes back to, for example, a coal unit isn't as great as it maybe once was. And so that does make economics more challenging.
Lanny, any thoughts on that? Or Kara, I don't mean to be leaving you out of these questions, but Lanny didn't make it up here, so we can pick on him more.
Yeah, I deserve that. Thank you, Commissioner Christman. So, I made a mental note to revise the sentence you read that precipitated your questions. I think what we do is we do use the generation we have to serve load that we have in the most reliable and economic way possible. What I can't guarantee you is our mix the most reliable mix it can be? And it's because we don't have any control over our ability to make it the most reliable mix. But given our responsibilities that we do have and the obligations that we have, you know, we certainly have the responsibility to use it in the most reliable and economic way possible. And then if I could go back to Commissioner Crocius's question about how to get involved or what can the commission do? And I just want to say, I think doing what you're doing now is exactly what you can be doing and should be doing. Roll your sleeves up, get engaged, get involved. I appreciate the fact that Commissioner Christman is in our RSC and participates and asks really good questions. I can tell you firsthand that he asks good questions. A lot of them I can't answer very well, but sometimes I try and sometimes I don't. But that's what you need to be doing. That's how you can help, is taking advantage of the opportunities that you have to help influence and drive some of these policies that or the decisions about these policies that need to be made.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Thank you. And this is probably for Lanny, but also for members, particularly Basin. So on the MISO side, OMS, which is the RSC equivalent, in MISO, we join forces with MISO and we do a joint survey every year of, it's a resource adequacy survey. We send it out to the members, they fill it out, and it looks at their, it provides a 5 to 10 year outlook on their resources compared to projected demand. And then it, you know, obviously the near term is more accurate and the long term just kind of flags any potential problems that might exist with retirements or, you know, changing resource mix. And then each of the entities is asked to provide a low, medium, or high level of certainty for certain resource decisions. It's, what does SPP do to look at that? Because you've mentioned, Lanny, you don't have all that good of a view of your future resource needs or what's gonna be on your system. What's your comparable tool that you guys use to get that kind of outlook in the SPP side?
We do something very similar. Every year we do a survey and then provide a report regarding the results of the survey about resources and load. And it's a five-year projection in each of our load-serving entities that operate within our footprint are expected to respond. And they tell us what their load forecasts are. They tell us what their resources are expected to look like over the next, each of the next 5 years, and whether or not they have any retirements. They inform us of their demand response. And so really all aspects of the inputs into resource adequacy are surveyed, and we provide that result and post it on our website. And we've just recently begun including that information in what we're referring to as our key performance indicators that we present to our board on a quarterly basis. When I spoke about that earlier, and mentioned that we do rely on our members to provide us the data, I just think that the date, one, it's a five-year outlook instead of a 10-year outlook. And then two, I think sometimes that information could be optimistic because of the fact that a lot of times our members provide us what they're certain about as the information. And if it's speculative, they're not necessarily wanting to make sure that any speculative information is provided. So, the one thing I heard you say about what MISO does is to ascribe some certainty to the information. I don't know that we do that. And if we do not do that, then maybe we ought to think about adding it.
Are you layering on any additional sort of, because you've expressed that that's one of the challenges is you don't really know what to plan for because you're not getting that clarity from your members far enough in advance. So what are you layering on to help you address that concern?
It's primarily the information that we use in our transmission planning studies. We do find that our members are generally more supportive of being a little more aggressive in terms of what that future mix could look like 10 years from now. And so we do see, futures that sometimes assume high amounts of renewables, both solar and wind and battery as well. Futures that might expect or assume certain policies will be in place that are carbon reduction related. And so those are the futures from a transmission planning perspective, I think, that we could rely upon to give us at least an indication of what potentially could happen. It's just that by the same token, what potentially could happen, very few of our members would be willing to say absolutely with 100% of certainty, that's what will happen.
Sure. And then if I could, one final on the same line of questioning. So there's President Biden has thrown out some pretty aggressive goals. Have you modeled those and looked at what would be involved, what would be required in your system to meet those goals, and what kind of assumptions are baked into that, just in terms of, again, informing your members, the public, like if this is what we're shooting for, here's what's going to be involved.
We have not yet done that, but we are talking about it and considering what role SPP as an independent organization should take with respect to being responsive. I know a lot of our members, in fact, I mentioned the script effort, it's come up a couple of times there about what SPP needs to do and what role we need to have with respect to informing that policy. And, to the extent that there's an opportunity to take advantage of it so that the transmission that does need to be built, that does provide resilience and that does provide economic value, that it's the right transmission. Because if we're not careful, if we lay low and we don't get involved, transmission will get built if the incentive package is approved, it may not be the best transmission. It may not be the right transmission. And so that is something that we're looking at. And I think strategically, I think, you know, we do need to get involved in some way, shape, or form.
Commissioner Karasha has a question or a comment.
It's probably part comment, part question. So you can answer as you see fit. Based on the trajectory of whether it's projected coal plant retirements or renewables coming online, a greater reliance on natural gas, and based on these 5 and 10 year, and I realize they're very general predictions, especially 10 years out, what would the impact have been of an event like this 10 years from now, knowing there were already challenges moving gas in particular to market, to the end user, to generate, and with greater reliance on gas and the challenges of putting pipeline infrastructure in the ground currently, just from a 30,000 foot level, the event was severe, but how bad would it have been if we had fast forwarded even 5 years from now?
Well, Commissioner Crossis, you're certainly putting me in the crosshairs here. I'll just tell you, my speculation is just that. It's just speculation. But if the exact same thing occurred 5 years from now, and again, this is where you've got lack of fuel supply, and if the assumptions in our planning studies in fact materialize, where we have less coal, less gas, more renewables, you know, we would also have more transmission. So it's hard to say with any certainty how all of that would balance out. But I don't know. I can't tell you, Commissioner. I'd be afraid of that kind of future if we didn't have enough generation that can show up when it needs to show up.
I'm frightened of that future too.
Yeah, fair enough. And I certainly didn't mean to put you in the crosshairs, Lanny, but it really does keep me up at night. This event was significant. It was severe. But, you know, what's at stake, not just tomorrow, but 5 years from now, 10 years from now? It's significant.
It is. And I tell you, I certainly don't want to see another one of these events in my career. And I can tell you pretty much everybody around the table in front of you doesn't want to see it either. And I know you don't. So I think there's a lot we can learn from this event, and we fully intend to learn from it. And again, back to the comment of affordability, that is always the balancing act. And I'll give Commissioner Feagin from South Dakota a lot of credit. She's leading the RSC review that is a major portion of our comprehensive review. And she said it very well the other day that whatever we do, we have to make sure that the benefit outweighs the cost.
A while ago, Lanny, you mentioned something to the effect of us rolling up our sleeves and feeling we're doing the right things here. And I think we're all willing to do that. And I see a room full of people who have been willing to spend their time and provide a lot of very thoughtful and insightful information today. I think the willingness is there. I will tell you, I start to lose some of the willingness if it just comes down to caring for a dog that's just not going to hunt. And so when I think back to February, And the events that took place that week, to me, the three most traumatic parts of the week were the load shed on Monday, the load shed on Tuesday, and then I believe, wasn't it Wednesday, when FERC closed their resiliency-related docket? And so I wonder whether any of the things we're discussing and talking about have a chance of being approved by the current FERC commission, Or am I misreading what they did with that resiliency docket?
Well, I'll respond this way. I think, you know, FERC has an obligation, and that includes reliability. And I think collectively as an organization, we're so much stronger. And if collectively we find things that need to be done, I think that carries a lot of weight. It carries a lot more weight if we can agree collectively as to what needs to happen than it would if, you know, any individual utility or any individual state were to walk into FERC's offices alone.
Well, thanks for that optimism.
I'll remain optimistic.
So I want to get into North Dakota's very specific role. And when we were talking about the load sheds, I asked you the question and you affirmed it, but I just want to review. So if those moments come up when load shed is required, SPP spreads it across the system based on the proportionate usage, but really doesn't reward states or zones or regions that are generation adequate or even generation exporters. Is that something that needs to be changed, or what can we do here to improve our system that will benefit us if the rest of the system doesn't take similar actions?
I know that our Operating Reliability Working Group, which is a key component of our operational review, is considering just that. And you're right, currently the way we allocate the responsibility for load shedding is based on an analysis that is done in advance that considers the energy consumption the previous season. So for example, if we're going to do a winter season load shedding, it would look at last winter season's usage of energy in the footprint. Or if it happened in the spring, it'd be the same thing. So, it's just spread on a pro rata basis. One of the things that I know several of our members have expressed a desire to do is to be a little bit more precise and location specific based on the current conditions, as opposed to conditions that were experienced a year ago. What I can't tell you though, Commissioner, is where we're going to end up on that, because again, collectively, it'd be nice if we got some agreement and consensus support about that approach.
And I don't mean to make it sound like in my mind it's just a real simple thing either, because for anybody, there probably are moments of generation inadequacy, and it's part of the point of being part of the team that you share to the extent you can. But it seems to me it's got to be kind of a balancing act in there of being part of a team as well as rewarding responsible actions.
No, and it's definitely worth considering. And I mean, there are advantages and disadvantages of a 100% regional approach versus some sort of sub-regional approach. And all of those have to be considered.
Okay. And Valerie Weigel has a comment.
And just to tack on what Lanny mentioned here at the end, that is one of the things that Basin is supportive of investigating, is understanding what a load shed by a reserve zone area might look like instead of by a load ratio share in the total market. That is one of the things, like I said, Basin supports. And then in our discussions too, Lanny touched a little bit on the comprehensive review that is going on within SPP. I know sitting on the market working group, I think we've had at least six different executive sessions, 4-hour sessions, consecutive Wednesday afternoons here, where we have talked about different topics that went on during the event and like bulleted, here are all the things where we think we can improve, or here are the areas that we want to talk about more as a team, as an SPP market participant team, and try to see if there's areas in there where we can make improvements. the market working group alone, I have a four-page bullet document of all the areas that market participants came up with, but that'll be combined with the other organization groups, organizational groups within SPP as well, and will be brought forward to their committee that will review all the various ideas and thoughts there. But load shedding by a zone rather than by total market is one of the things that Basin is supportive of investigating.
And I can't tell you how happy I am that people like you are part of that market working group. So thank you for that. Does Basin participate in the operational ORWG?
Yes, I believe we have a voting member on there as well. And I had captured all the different working groups where we have a voting member. There's almost 20 different working groups within the SPP construct where we have a voting member.
Mr. Linke, how much is WAPA participating in SPP activities as a really large transmission operator within the system? What's your level of participation?
We're probably participating at the same level that Basin is. I don't have a complete list, a current list, but I know a list that I looked at maybe about a year and a half ago. We were in the same range with 20-some representatives on various committees. I'm on a couple, two or three SPP committees. So we are very, very active.
Central Power?
We have a representative on the MOPSI, Market Operations and Policy Committee. Okay.
And what about McKenzie and Montreal Williams?
Montreal has a MOPSI rep as well, because we're a transmission owner in SPP, and I follow three or four different working groups as well.
We're not a member of SPP, so we're not part of that group.
I'm sorry, I thought you were.
No, we are not.
Yeah. Paul, anybody else have any thoughts on what we could be doing in North Dakota? Tom?
Well, we're tightly aligned with Western, obviously. We've jointly planned transmission. So when I think of, you know, North Dakota, it kind of group in with South Dakota, because that's where the bulk of our generation, as well as WAPA's, is, and transmission as well. I guess one of the things we're doing, we have natural gas-fired units, obviously some in South Dakota, some in North Dakota, you know, the units in North Dakota are a little closer to the production out of the Bakken, less risk of fuel supply outage there, we think. And again, as Val indicated, we really didn't have natural gas supply issues for our units, but we did experience some higher prices on units in South Dakota, eastern South Dakota. And so we're looking at potential on-site storage. Again, we think it's going to be pricey. We have an obligation to be reliable. We have an obligation to keep our costs down as well. So we're looking at some of those possibilities as far as on-site fuel storage. I guess to just follow that up a little bit as well, and I think Lanny hit on some issues before on resource adequacy. When we talk about some incentives, and there's some market incentives for reliability as well, but there probably has to be some requirements too, is kind of we're pondering that if you're going to have and require units to have adequate fuel supply to enhance that resource adequacy, you may not be able to do it just through incentives, and there might have to be some additional requirements. And so again, we'll see what the final report says, but that's our current thinking, is there's going to be need to be some type of requirements as well.
Thank you. And the last area that I wanted to make sure that we get to explore while we have the SPP side of the equation here this morning is even before the winter events, SPP had begun the process of adding a pretty large area to its footprint. And incidentally, a big part of that addition includes much of Wyoming, which is Kara Fornstrom's native land. And Kara is, by the way, the former utility commission chairman there. So you certainly know a lot about that addition, I'm certain. So we started that process, and by the way, a big part of that new additional footprint area would be Basin Electric, additional Basin Electric territory. So we started that process and then got to the February event. How does that additional footprint area change the equation as far as SPP's reliability concerns moving forward, assuming that it would go, that the expansion goes forward?
Well, Commissioner, first and foremost, if I remember correctly, the interconnections that we have, they're DC ties between the 14 state footprint in the east and the system that is at least expressing a desire to join the RTO, and those capabilities are, I think, aggregate up to about 720 megawatts. So that looks like basically a 720 megawatt generator that's added to the fleet in terms of how it would benefit the 14 state region in the east. So it gives you more access to more energy. And oh, by the way, DC ties don't distinguish between wind or gas or coal that makes up the 720 megawatts. If it can find 720 megawatts that can flow from west to east or vice versa, it's going to use it. And so that's the reliability benefit that is, or at least would be, immediately made available to SPP. We'd have the ability to dispatch that generation directly, just like we do the generation we have today.
Tom?
Well, and again, I think there's a lot of activity going on in the West, and you know, we obviously are very excited about having the possibility of a full-fledged RTO in the West as well. But SPP currently provides reliability coordination services on the West to a number of utilities. There's the energy imbalance market that SPP administers on the West as well. That started up February 1st, and that was, we think, a significant accomplishment. And we're looking forward to more discussions as a potential full RTO in the West. Again, those DC ties fully optimized in a one market solution and bring along some reliability benefits as well, we think. So we're excited.
And if anything, you're feeling like it should enhance reliability as opposed to lessening it.
Yeah, it's certainly not going to detract. Again, Lanny indicated, you know, the transfer capability, it's not huge. So, you know, again, that reliability benefit is somewhat restricted by the capacity of the ties. But there's something there. And I think it would have helped.
Kara, you know that area better than any of us.
Well, I just want to make a couple of points. First, just to note that SPP did receive some imports from the West during the February event. It was limited, but any expansion would obviously increase the opportunity to import. It just increases your geographical footprint. The cold temperatures that were being felt in the existing footprint weren't necessarily were as uncommon in the Western footprint. So the generation was there and some imports were available to SPP, and that would be maximized during the expansion effort. But I just want to go back to your other question about what the commission could do. I just wanted to note that you are all very active regionally and nationally. And I think it's important for you to share your experience and your expertise and voice your views to other commissioners in other states that are making these kind of resource decisions so they can benefit from your experience on this and point out the real issues that we're facing. There's no better testimonial to that than from a commissioner. So I would encourage you to keep up those efforts.
Thank you. And Lloyd, that Western expansion is a lot of area that WAPA is the transmission operator in. Any thoughts on that possibility?
Yeah, we're just like Tom was mentioning, we're very positive in wanting to move forward with expansion of SPP into the Western interconnection, and are very active on all the groups that are discussing the various tariff modifications that are may or may not be required. So we're looking forward to getting all of our facilities and all our generation and load. At least UGP is looking forward to getting all our generation and load into the SPP market, because our load generation in central Montana currently is not in the SPP market because it's in the Western interconnection. And so we'd look forward to that. On the DC ties, it provides some additional capacity, though I know the DC tie we operate was fully committed with generation and flows from the west to the east. It wouldn't be able to provide any additional benefit because it was fully utilized during the event in February.
How does your generation in Montana compare in scale to what we're familiar with here in North Dakota or in South Dakota?
It's significantly less, but it's still a vital part of what is needed for the Dakotas. We have more resource than we have load in the Western interconnection. And so we have firm network rights across the DC tie so that we can bring generation from the Western interconnection to serve our load in the Eastern interconnection. So while it may be a tenth of what we have in the East, there's a good portion of it that is needed in order to serve the load in the Dakotas.
Thank you. Good. I'm ready to move on. Yep, Commissioner Fedorchak.
All right, I have a few random things that I wasn't sure where to fit in, so I just thought I'd keep them and see how we were towards the end. But how about you? I do have a number of things to cover still. Okay. I still think we'll finish well before our 12:30 time. So one question, so kind of to Kara's encouragement that we continue to stay engaged nationally. On NARUC, I'm on the gas committee, and ever since I started in this on this job 8 years ago, I've heard talk about the importance of gas-electric coordination, but it still is a huge challenge, and we saw that again this last winter. So obviously there's some big gaps there that aren't being addressed. So it's not necessarily a question I need answered right now, but if you guys have specific blocks of people or type the areas within the gas industry that are essential players that aren't currently where the coordination is lacking, where we need to build more conversations or encourage FERC to get involved with rules or whatever it is, I would really be interested and open to you providing specifics on that issue, because I will be tackling this through the Gas Committee on NARUC pretty strongly for the next couple of years. And I've made that same pitch to MISO as well, and we'll do it again this afternoon. So any ideas for where specifically in the gas electric coordination we need to focus? I'm real interested in trying to drill down on that. So that's not really a question, but secondly, so this is more of a issue that we were talking about a little bit ago, but you know, there's so many different drivers of the change that's occurring. Some of it is just technology. Some of it is economic opportunity for developers. Some of it is state policy goals, and some of it are corporate or company goals. So, and there's probably other drivers too. Where I really struggle as commissioner and on OMS is what is the state's role, or say the RTO's role, or even the, you know, the distribution company or the basins of the world's role in facilitating goals, specific kind of generation type goals or carbon free goals of your customers, of the market players or participants, the load. What's your role in that, and where should those costs be placed? How do we work that into this mix? Because currently, I think we can all face it, the overall, those costs are being socialized to everybody right now, to a large degree, not 100%, but to a large degree, but for the cost to connect to the interconnection costs, those are largely being shared or socialized across the board or paid for by utility customers within. But when it gets down to specific, like the Googles and the Apples and the Microsofts of the world, the Walmart saying, we want 100% carbon free, great, all for it, as long as you're willing to bear that cost. But how do we make that happen? That's where it gets so challenging. Manny, how is SPP working with that, and Basin, how are you guys working that with that with your own? Because you have some corporate goals yourselves, I believe.
Well, Commissioner, I can, you asked a question about what should be, and I don't have an answer for that, but I can tell you what is right now. And, you know, our role today is to make sure that the transmission grid can reliably and affordably interconnect the new loads that the utilities are pursuing and the generation that is being pursued. And in some cases, it's been pursued in response to public policies that you mentioned. And if regional transmission is needed to support those goals, and in some cases mandates, it is cost shared. And of course, in SPP, it's cost shared according to our highway byway approach, which means if it's 300 kV and above, it's being allocated, the costs are allocated to all load in the footprint. So that's SPP's role today. And I know that doesn't answer your question about what should be.
Are you looking at any new solutions as the penetration levels get higher and perhaps more driven by differing goals between states and certain utilities within your mix?
Well, it kind of gets back to the statement I said earlier. I think if, at least from a reliability perspective, we're going to have to be a little more out front and informing. So then in that regard, our role would be an informing role, so that you know, the parties and the entities that are involved in making those decisions understand the impacts of those decisions. Mm-hmm. And I do think that's something that we are talking about it strategically now. We're producing a new strategic plan, and one of our strategic initiatives that I expect will end up in that strategic plan will be what we refer to as Grid of the Future. And part of Grid of the Future isn't just making it happen and paying for it, but it's also understanding it and what it needs to be, and sharing information so that people can make really well-informed decisions that are appropriate.
Okay.
I appreciate the question. And so I think from our perspective, you know, lowest cost, we want to be a low-cost provider, and we want to provide reliable service. I mean, but within that, then what we've said is kind of an all of the above strategy. It's got some coal, it's got some gas, it's got all of those. And within that diversity will help us, you know, keep the reliability up as well. So that, as far as the strategy, I think one of the things that we appreciate within SPP is, and I think it's within their attachment J, if you will, there's some safe harbor limits so that if there's entities that become too generation rich or too wind rich, and it starts to impose excessive costs on, as far as transmission costs on the system, there are limits to it. And there's a safe harbor limit within that attachment J. And those are some things that, we'll pick up a little bit of transmission if it's, you know, gone through the transmission process, whether that's a generation interconnection request requesting firm service or just a regular transmission service request. So those are some of the things that I think are some limit switches in my mind that limit the costs that might get allocated if there are entities out there that are, again, getting overly generation rich, overly wind rich, et cetera.
Interesting. Anybody else want to weigh in on this one?
Well, I guess I'll weigh in a little bit to give some credit to our legislature, U.S. commissioners, our delegation, to all the work that's been done in that area to help deal with, if carbon is the issue, then let's find ways to deal with that carbon at the federal level with things like 45Q, stuff like that. Or here in North Dakota, when we're talking about carbon capture, utilization, storage, all those types of efforts that have been made here have been intensive and comprehensive and been talked about for a long time and are continuing to talk about. And this legislative session was talked about even more. So I think credit to all the folks in this room and not in this room who are taking up that flag and fighting for it every day.
Back. What I appreciate about North Dakota policymakers' approach is North Dakota taxpayers are paying for that goal. Like, that's something that the people here have determined through their representatives in the legislature that that's a priority and they're paying for it. And I think that's how these kinds of policies should be addressed. But.
Matthew Stoltz again. Lanny mentioned this earlier in the meeting today about the Clean Power Plan. Base Electric was, I think, the primary plaintiff pushing back against that that agenda. And I was part of crafting the testimony regarding transmission. We dodged a huge bullet there. I don't think anybody realizes that if that Clean Power Plan would have passed, it would have been almost Armageddon, because it did not allow any time for us to convert from fossil over to clean energy. So the point is that there's demagogues that push those kinds of ideas and have really little or no concern for the implications of their decisions. So we have to really be really careful when folks like Apple and Google and whatnot start talking about totally renewable and start pushing that agenda. That doesn't result in rules that we have to follow that can't be met. So we have to stay on top of that going forward so something like that doesn't repeat itself. That's all.
So I
want to take this discussion one step further with a question for you, Mr. Linke. When, and I'm not talking about someone, you know, putting a solar panel on their garage or a little wind turbine in the backyard. I'm talking about when entities start adding a megawatt or multiple megawatts, and whether it's for because of a green concept or just because they feel it'll save them money. When entities do that kind of thing, then the general costs of maintaining the system that they rely on to make it reliable when their own system doesn't work just gets passed on to everyone else. If North Dakota had a policy, or multiple states had a policy, whereby those folks who choose to do those kinds of things will then be the first in the area to get load shed. Would that be a doable thing? Or I realize you're a federal agency. What would your thoughts be on something like that, where those folks that rely on the rest, if to back their own systems up, and that will then be the first ones for shed?
Interesting question. I mean, as far as like transmission service, that behind the meter type of generation continues, is supposed to continue to pay for the transmission system, even when they're utilizing that renewable resource, whatever it may be. As far as being first one off type of thing, that would require changes to the FERC rules on the open access tariff and on curtailment of load, because basically if you have firm transmission service, you have firm transmission service and you're supposed to curtail on a pro rata basis everybody that has firm transmission service. So I don't think it's something that could be done by like WAPA or SPP. Probably would need some sort of FERC changes to the transmission service outs, the tariffs. I don't know if Lanny has some different thoughts as to whether he thinks they could do that sort of thing within the confines of the existing open access transmission tariffs.
Well, before Lanny goes then, so am I understanding you correctly that really the important thing for us to be doing then is to be making sure that the system is set up correctly, that they are in fact paying for their share of the transmission system, even when they're using their own.
And it's my understanding that the existing FERC rules are that you're supposed to account for the behind the meter generation in the transmission bill.
Yeah. I know that's the policy. I hope we are achieving it. But Lanny, go ahead. If you had anything to add to that.
I really don't have a whole lot to add to it. I think Lloyd hit on some points that up until now I really hadn't been concentrating on, but he does make some good points that there is FERC policy that that kind of governs how we are expected to behave in this regard. And that doesn't mean that we can't propose something that, as long as it's just and reasonable, could be acceptable to FERC. But it's always harder once there's a policy in place, it's harder to overcome that. But it's not impossible. It just has to be just and reasonable. And that's the standard by which FERC judges any proposal to make a change to a tariff.
Madam Chairman, this would probably be a good lunch break point. I have about a minute of personal privilege but I don't know if there's any other questions or if staff has anything that we're getting. Well, this is complex stuff, and none of us are born or necessarily get elected knowing all this stuff. And I just want to highlight a team over here of Patrick Fawn, our public utilities director, and at the far end, and Jack Hsu at this end, our legal counsel. And next to Jack is Adam Renfant, who kind of specializes in MISO-related stuff on the side, along with all his other duties at the commission. And the second one from the end is Victor Shook, who I left you for last, but he, along with his other work, specializes in the SPP side of things. and has been such an extraordinary resource for me in able to do my work at the RSC. And so after all this discussion, I did want to highlight our staff and certainly extend appreciation to them.
All right. Agreed with all of that, Randy. We are, 15 minutes early. So I think, we were scheduled to come back at 1:15 because I know there's eagerness to get done a little early to catch flights. We are going to keep a 45-minute break. We'll try to be back and be ready to start at 1. And you're encouraged. They're expecting us not that you can order from the cafeteria. They have a wide variety of options. And we should easily be able to eat and be back in 45 minutes through that. So thank you.